All right. Calling to order this meeting of the House Early Childhood Finance and Policy Division. We'll start by having the clerk take the roll.
Representative Pinto, Chair.
Present.
Representative Katiza Watun, Vice Chair. Representative Franson. Representative Bonner.
Present.
Representative Damas.
Present.
Representative Heintzman. Representative Morrison.
Present.
Representative Pryor.
Present.
Representative Wasilek. Representative West is excused.
Okay, and we do have a quorum, so I will entertain a motion to approve the minutes of our March 12th meeting. Anyone?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Heintzman moves approval of the March 12th minutes. Any additions or corrections? Hearing none, all in favor of approval, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. And any opposed? Okay. Thank you, Representative Heintzman and members. We have minutes March 12th. So our first bill up is House File 1384, so we'll call my seatmate, Representative Hurd, to the testifier's table. And so nice to have her in our committee. If I can have a motion to, and I should probably confirm. So is this just going to be moved? Okay. So if I can have a motion to put the bill in front of us, it'll be laid over for possible inclusion in the division report.
I'd like to make that motion.
Representative Pryor makes that motion. And so, Representative Herr, we have your bill in front of us, and so to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, the bill in front of you is House File 1384. This bill gives – oh, and by the way, before I start, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I was told that I'm supposed to bring treats, but I'm going to follow our majority leader's advice and say stop bringing treats, and so I did.
And Representative Herr, I think I said very early on the thought was that because I kind of agree with that, that there's although I certainly enjoy treats, so no problem at all.
Point of order, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it.
All right, Representative Herr, please.
Thank you. So the bill gives this bill 1384 gives statutory authority to the Minnesota Department of Human Services to add Head Start programs and tribal programs to the list of programs allowed to use DHS's background system. Just to give you a little bit of background, Head Start programs must fully implement a new federally required background check process no later than September 30th of 2019. The only way that this can be met is if they are allowed to use DHS's background study system. The challenge is that under current Minnesota law, Head Start programs and tribal programs can only use the system for their employees who work in center-based programs. However, these programs operate in other settings, such as tribal agencies, home visits, and they have employees who provide services outside of the center-based settings. It's important for Head Start and tribal programs to have access to DHS's background system in order to be compliant with federal requirements. This is a non-controversial bill, and this language was part of Governor Dayton's 2018 supplemental budget recommendations and was included in the vetoed 2018 supplemental budget bill, and there was no opposition to this language in 2018. It's also in the governor's budget recommendation for this year. And so I'm going to turn it over to my testifier with your permission, Mr. Chair, Gail Kelly, so that she can maybe talk a little bit more about the bill itself.
Thank you, Representative Herr. And Ms. Kelly, please identify yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Gail Kelly. I'm the executive director for the Minnesota Head Start Association. It's a pleasure to be here and to talk a little bit about Head Start. Head Start provides it provides child and family development services to around 15,000 children across the state. As you heard from Representative Herr, we offer those services in center-based opportunities as well as home visiting. We do partnerships with schools, and we employ over 3,500 teachers, home visitors, bus drivers, child care providers, and each one of them needs a federal background study with a fingerprint. And we have heard from DHS that they are not able to provide us with all of those services unless our children, our employees are working in licensed child care centers. And so some of our employees are not under that category, and that's the consequence why this bill has been presented. We also serve, we have 8 tribal members in our Head Start program, and they also provide child care. And so they have authorized me to be able to say that they approve of this statute, and they really hope that the committee will pass it on for approval. We waited a couple years for this to get going, so we would really appreciate getting this glitch settled.
Good. Thank you, Ms. Kelly. Representative Herr, any other testifiers from you?
No, that's it, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. And anyone from the public who wishes to testify on this bill? I'm not seeing any questions from members. Well, Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So to the bill author, Representative Herr, do you see, I'm looking at 1.8, 1.9, and then also I think there's a reference to a background study on 2.3, but I'm not seeing anywhere that indicates where the dollars are coming from to pay for the background checks. I'm sure you have that information.
Yes.
Representative Herr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Heintzman. So is there a fiscal impact? Well, the background study would increase revenues for DHS, but because the fees only cover the cost of doing the studies, the proposal is revenue neutral, and so that's the information we have regarding that, around the cost impact.
And I'm seeing Mr. Berg nodding his head as well. So Representative, I'll just ask, who pays that fee? Ms. Kelly, yeah.
Yes, Representative. The local programs pay the fee.
Okay, thank you. So looks like that's it in terms of questions. Anything else? No, so then in that case, I will lay over House File 1384 for possible inclusion division report. And thank you so much, Representative Herr, for bringing this forward. And Ms. Kelly, for all of your work. Head Start's a terrific program. So thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and the committee
thank
for
you.
Listening.
And so moving on to House File 1382, Representative Richardson, come on up. Glad to have you in front of our committee. And if I can have a motion to put House File 1382 before us for possible inclusion in a division report. Somebody available
so
for that?
Moved.
Okay, Representative Morrison makes that motion. Thank you. And Representative Richardson, please dive in and explain your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1382 is a bill that fixes a problem that advocates and parents believed was addressed during the 2015 session. In 2015, legislation was passed that allowed Metro Deaf School, a special education charter school for children who are deaf, deafblind, and hard of hearing, to accept preschool children through parent choice. There was strong bipartisan support for the bill. The school believed that the legislation covered all preschoolers, but learned that it did not include children 0 to 3. This bill amends the current statute and adds the age range to birth to 5. It would also cover the estimated costs in fiscal year 20 and 21. There would be additional costs to the state and additional costs to the school district. Metro Deaf School is the only school in the metro area that provides preschool instruction in American Sign Language. The school has estimated that there would be 3 to 5 students a year in that expanded age range. I learned while I studied American Sign Language and Deaf culture at the University of Minnesota how critically important it is for preschoolers who are deaf to be placed in language-rich environments. Only about 10% of babies that are deaf are born to parents who are deaf as well. 90% are born to hearing parents, the majority of which do not know American Sign Language. I have a number of testifiers here with me today to also talk about the bill. And if it's okay with you, Mr. Chair, I can move on to Susan Lane Outlaw, the superintendent of Metro Deaf School.
That would be terrific. So please identify yourself and begin, whoever's going next.
I'm Dr. Susan Lane Outlaw. I'm the executive director at Metro Deaf School.
And
thank
please,
you, yeah. Chairperson.
Thank you.
And committee for allowing us to speak today. World's best workforce really calls for all children to be kindergarten ready. That's one of the big goals and one of the tenets. We can't have children kindergarten ready if they don't have language until they're 3. And that's significant. I mean, we have children who are born to hearing families who don't know the language, and typically on the IFSP, our individual family service plan, that they receive until they're 3 years old when they receive an IEP, an individual education program. Those students are getting typically 1 hour a week of home visits. Sometimes it's 2 times a month home visits, where a lot of that service is directed towards the families, giving them resources and helping them work together. We're proposing that we currently work with some districts and they place students with us. And Laura White is a one parent where the district actually placed the child with us at 2 years old. There are other districts that don't. And what we found is that we have a haves and have-nots. We have some families that their districts readily place with us and other families that are starving for this access for their child, and the districts don't place with us. And I think with equity of education, that's a huge piece that we, in the state of Minnesota, we've always championed, parent choice and making sure that all children have access. And I have numerous research about language deprivation and how important having early language access is. Anyone who has a child, if you think about not providing language access until they're three, it's crazy and it's insane. I mean, to really think about all that time they're missing. So that's a little bit about our program, what we provide, and how we serve really the whole metro area. And again, over 80% of our students are resident district placed. So we're very unique in that regard. We're the only charter school in the state that we're almost all district-placed students. So we work with districts. We're not against them.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. And then the next testifier.
Hi. Thank you, Chair and Committee, for listening to me this morning. My name is Laura White. I'm a mother of three children. My oldest, Zachary, is 8. My second oldest, Jeremiah, is 6. And my daughter, Janelle, is 2.5. She will not be 3 until July. We moved here 2 years ago from another state where my oldest sons were able to receive birth through three services. And when we moved here, realized that was not an option. We were able to receive home visits 2 times a month for about an hour, which, like Susan testified, really provided more about how to support the family. But fortunately for my children, my husband and I are fluent in ASL, and we have hearing loss, so we know how to provide that language access. But as 90% of deaf children that are born, most are born to hearing parents that don't have that fluent language access that they need. So when Janelle was only able to receive home visits 2 times a month, in addition, she was able to receive once a month county visits, but that was with other peers that were not signing. And so we were very fortunate that our local district was able to place her at MDS this past fall. And she will be turning 3 in July and is already putting together 5 to 6 utterance sentences. Her language has just really developed. She's with a peer group of about 7 students right now that she's in all day, 4 days a week with other children that are signing with her. And it's just an amazing environment. To see the difference in being able to provide services to children all day with staff and students that are peer groups of appropriate aging is just amazing. Sorry, I'm a little nervous.
That's okay.
But this is a really, really important thing for me. I have, as like I said, 3 children. My grandmother was a teacher of the deaf and hard of hearing. I have deaf parents who were not able to receive earlier intervention services. They didn't even receive access to sign language until they were 8 and 12 years old. And I can see the difference in their growth. My older sons, as I mentioned, who receive birth through 3 services, are actually doing academically well, that they are reading and writing comparative to hearing age peers, which is not the norm. So being able to have early language access really does make a difference in their academic growth later on.
Thank you. And so glad to hear that your kids are getting such good services. That's great. Good. Thank you. Representative Richardson, you have another testifier, looks like. Come on up and please identify yourself and then please proceed.
Hi, my name is Sarah Klarstrom. I'm a mother of a daughter who is in preschool right now at MDS. Thank you.
Would you mind spelling your last name? Sorry.
Yes. Just, K-L-A-R-S-T-R-O-M.
Thank you. Yeah, please continue.
So I prepared something. I'm just going to read off because I want to make sure I catch all of what I want to say. My daughter was born deaf, and we knew that coming out of the hospital that she failed her newborn hearing screen, which is somewhat normal for a situation that she had. She was born early. So we did the normal follow-up with her regular pediatrician and failed those hearing tests as well. So a lot of our time spent as we were on maternity leave was in doctor's visits. She received her first set of hearing aids at 8 weeks old, and those hearing aids did not provide access to hearing for her. So she, at 12 months old, received her cochlear implant. At that time, we realized that that wasn't a benefit to her either, just based on some anatomy that issues that she has. So at that time, we ended up moving from St. Michael to our current resident district in Osseo, because they do have a more kind of diverse type of special ed program. But when we were there, we realized that she would not get access to ASL a lot of the time that she would be in those preschool classes, because it's a combination of ASL, SEE, which is Sign Exact English, and an oral program. And so when they're in that oral program, she would not receive access to her education. So at that point, we went and toured Metro Deaf School, and Nora was placed at just under 2.5 years old, and that was last year. And at that point, before she went to school, she was not smiling. She did not really show much emotion because she just didn't have access to communicate those things to her family, and she didn't really have peers that could communicate with her as well. So after her first year, she was having complete sentences. She was able to show emotion, tell us what she needed. And at this point, she's 3.5 years old, and she will tell you what's going on. And it's really great to see because she can communicate with her older hearing sister and to be able to have a peer group at such a young age that is supportive. And having parents that are supportive, that are in similar situations is really, really key. I think the biggest thing that I want to make sure that I land today is that regardless of whatever that potential inequality is, whether it's disability, race, gender, whatever that might be, to not allow students to have the same opportunities to learn and excel, and language is one of these here today, we're not giving kids the opportunity to be a productive member of society, regardless of who they are and what challenges they may have to rise with.
Good. Thank you. Thank you for sharing your experience. Thank you. Representative Richardson, any other testifiers for you?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. And any member of the public who wishes to provide testimony for or against the bill? And no? And then member questions or comments? Looks like there was. Oh, I'm sorry. It looks like, please come on up. And identify, here we can make space. Yeah, please identify yourself for the record, and then please proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I feel like I need a booster chair.
Yeah, today. No, that's yeah. that's an awkward spot.
So how short I am.
And pull the microphone down just towards you. Thanks.
And Mr. Chairman, I'm not testifying against the bill. I just wanted to raise an issue for the committee to consider. I'm sure all of you have heard. I'm Mary Gilbert from the St. Paul Public Schools, but talking on behalf of the metro area schools. All of you have heard about the special education cross-subsidy and how much the gap is between what schools are spending on special education and what they're receiving from the state and federal government. And one of the issues that the governor's budget is trying to deal with, and that has been a discussion, is how to deal with some of the tuition reimbursement that has happened. And that's because of the one-year lag in the formula. So anytime the legislature adds a new service or a new duty, whether it's for Metro Deaf or any other class of students, there's basically a one-year lag in the formula where the resident district, if it's an out-of-district placement, ends up substantially paying for almost the entire cost of that program. There were some recommendations in the governor's budget, and we're hoping if the committee considers to move forward with this, that they would consider addressing that as part of that fix.
Okay, good. Thank you. Thank you for that. And I actually had a question that raised Representative Richardson. There were comments about there being an additional cost for this, and I'm wondering if there's a fiscal note, and it may be that just if you can explain that cost piece, either you or testifiers.
Sure, there's a fiscal note request, and I'm not sure if there are, because in terms of the number of students that were estimated, we're looking at about 3 to 5 students that would be within that age range, and not sure if the testifiers want to say anything else about potential costs.
Superintendent?
Thank you. Yes, we're looking at, depending on the age of the child, the services would vary. So it's a little hard to pinpoint exactly. We're talking about having an hour and a half parent-infant class, an hour home visit every week for our youngest infants. And then once they would be 2 years old, then it would ramp up to where they would attend 4 days a week, but in mornings only. So it varies. It's not a linear.
I guess as long as the bill is being laid over, then we'll have, it sounds like a fiscal note has been requested, Representative Richardson, so we should have that information soon enough, I suppose, if I'm understanding you right.
Yes,
okay.
Mr. Chair.
Okay, good. Thank you. Any other member questions or comments? And seeing none, so then the bill will be laid over for possible inclusion. And thank you so much, Representative Richardson, and testifiers. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And so, Representative Richardson, you have House File 1785 as the next bill. And so if I can have a motion to put that bill in front of us for possible inclusion in a division report.
So moved.
Representative Bonner moves that. Thank you. And and there is an amendment to this bill, an author's amendment. It's coded A1. Representative Bonner, would you move the A1 amendment as well?
Mr. Chair, I would be happy to move the A1 amendment.
Thank you so much. This will be to get the bill in the form that the author wishes. Any discussion regarding the A1? And hearing none, all in favor of approval of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
And any opposed? Okay. So the bill, House File 1785, is now in the form which the author would like. And so Representative Richardson, to your bill, House File 1785.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1785, as amended, would limit dismissals for children participating or enrolled in pre-kindergarten programs. The data from the National Survey of Children's Health highlights the prevalence and frequency of dismissals regarding preschool-age children. In 2016, an estimated 50,000 preschoolers were suspended at least once. Another 17,000 were expelled from preschool programs across the U.S. This translates into, on an average school day, that roughly 250 preschoolers are being dismissed. Those who are not familiar with these statistics are often shocked to hear that students in preschool are three times more likely to be suspended than youth in grades K through 12. We also know that these dismissals are disproportionately impacting students with disabilities and students of color and students that are indigenous. Minnesota is home to some of the worst disparities in discipline. Nationally, black students are suspended at a rate three times more often than white students. Here in Minnesota, black students are suspended or expelled at a rate eight times more often than white students. American Indian students are 10 times more likely than white students to be suspended or expelled. Students with disabilities are twice as likely to be suspended or expelled than students without. As I understand it, we are not currently tracking or reporting on preschool suspensions or expulsions in Minnesota, which is problematic. But even without the preschool data, we have a real problem in Minnesota. These disparities in discipline contribute to a cradle-to-prison pipeline that harms our children, their families, and our community. These disparities in discipline are simply unacceptable. There's a saying that it takes a village to raise a child. Well, it also takes a village to fail a child as well. Early childhood is such a developmentally crucial time period. It sets the foundation for healthy brain development and learning to get along in the world. If we're not investing in our little ones proactively on the front end, it will be detrimental on the back end with the societal and economic costs that we simply can't afford. As a first step, we must employ alternatives and can no longer tolerate this practice of dismissing preschoolers. And if it's okay with Mr. Chair, I would like to introduce our first testifier, parent Susan Montgomery.
Good morning, Chair and committee members.
Good morning.
My name is Susan Montgomery. I am a single disabled parent that volunteers as an advocate around education issues, social justice, and children's mental health. Today I'm here to talk about my son, Tay, who is currently in eighth grade at Roseville Area Schools. I am proud to say he is doing very well right now, but not without a huge cost. It started when he was in preschool over 10 years ago, later requiring an IEP, which sent him even into more into our broken education system. For my son, who identifies black, that has been an extremely harmful and discriminatory experience. On several occasions during that time, he was removed from class or sent to a principal's office, unofficially asked to stay home for part of the following day that didn't require the school to have a form filled out, removed from special activities with peers, and even officially suspended with required paperwork claiming he was disruptive. He has had code yellow lockdowns called on him, been illegally restrained and arrested, put in illegal seclusion rooms like broom closets, had ropes or other materials tied around his neck and waist, segregated from regular classrooms, and severely abused by staff, cops, and students all before second grade. Also, he was suspended, academically transferred, and expelled with no chance to appeal or find healthy alternatives, causing huge opportunity gaps like being unable to read and write at grade level. He has been in 17 schools or related programs since he started this education journey. Imagine being young and vulnerable but not being able to attend classes with your peers or being disciplined because of your disability. The sad thing about telling his story for so long, hoping and praying for change, is also knowing that little to nothing has been done. He was diagnosed with PTSD and TBI from the trauma and still has flashbacks and nightmares. Please note he isn't out of the woods yet either, and many other children are dealing with these discipline policies and racial disparities today. Our kids deserve to be in school. We need more support and access to resources for families like mine. Keeping them safe in school and giving them positive tools for success will set their future with great outcomes. So I'm asking you please to support House File 1785.
Thank you for your testimony. Thank you. And so then your next testifier, Representative Richardson. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Amy Elkema Baxter, and I'm here today as a 20-year special education teacher for St. Paul Public Schools and now as a special education consultant mentoring and supporting first-year special education teachers in St. Paul. I'm also an executive member of the Special Education Advisory Council and a member of the Ramsey County Individuals with Developmental Disabilities Advisory Council. What do you do as a parent when your child is acting up at home? What is your response? Do you send them to their room and ignore them, or do you help them figure out what they need by teaching strategies for calming and soothing themselves and instilling in them the message that they are valued and important? I want to share a story about one of my students, a young black special education male who had a long history of dismissals and suspensions due to acting out behaviors, or as I like to call it, not getting his needs met. From the very beginning of his school career, he was labeled as a bad kid and institutionalized as other. And as we all know, when you're told something often enough, you start to believe it. He had learned that acting out was the easiest way to avoid difficult and uncomfortable situations. You could see that he was missing some real foundational academic skills as well as relationship and problem-solving skills with his peers due to his repeated suspensions and dismissals. I decided to make this student my number one priority. What became clear very quickly was that this young student with a history of dismissals and suspensions due to his acting out was actually a marshmallow, craving attention and melting into anyone who would give him an ear and a chance. The more he felt valued and listened to, the more engaged he became with his learning academically as well as socially and emotionally. And furthermore, he was able to internalize the message that he was an integral part of our classroom community. His occurrences of absences and tardies also decreased. And as a matter of fact, this is when he started to hold me accountable for my schedule. Because of our growing relationship due to his increased time in school, I had to inform him ahead of time about any absences that I might have due to trainings or meetings that would take me out of the classroom. The only way that we as educators can give our students what they need, a free and appropriate public education, the basic tenets of IDEA, is to actually have them physically in the classroom. I do not want to repeat any data that's already been shared with you about suspensions and dismissals, but I do want to say it's clear that we have a problem. We have a well-built pre-K to prison pipeline that we must dismantle, and this bill is an important step in that direction. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on this critical issue, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Richardson, any other testifiers for you?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we do have several people who've signed up to testify. If we can have Ms. Burnside come up. And please identify yourself once you get up there. No problem. That's fine. Identify yourself and then proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Brenda Burnside. I am before you today as a 12-year veteran of Roseville Area Middle School, as a special ed teaching assistant, also as a parent of two children who have graduated and come through the St. Paul Public Schools. And today, rather than focus on just the talking points of your bill, I would like to consider the message that we are sending to our youngest learners. by pushing them out of school at this early age. I think about myself as a parent and how you put your children on the school bus on the first day of school. And I think about the fact that we pack our dreams and our goals and our hopes for our children in those backpacks and in those lunch boxes. And I think about how vulnerable they must feel. If you could imagine being 5 years old again and it being your first day of school. I think about the fact that the parents are as nervous as the children are. But I think about the fact that the kids, they wonder, do I know enough? Have I learned enough? Am I going to make friends at school, right? And then I think about that whole first week and all the things that could go wrong. If you have the wrong backpack or if you have the wrong lunch, you come in with a peanut butter and jelly sandwich and somebody comes in with sushi, you know, things like that. You know, you have to worry about those
probably
things.
Gonna stick with the peanut, you're probably going to stick with the peanut butter and jelly, but yeah, please continue.
Exactly. So I think about the fact that you might have the wrong lunch. You might be wearing the wrong clothes, right? You might even have a blankie that keeps you secure inside your backpack. And a child sees that and already you're targeted, right? So after that first week of school, can you imagine being suspended? I haven't been suspended for my entire educational career. I've never been suspended. But I just think about that first week seems like an eternity to that five-year-old or that four-year-old. And I think about the fact that at the end of that week, they say, I don't belong here. Or where do I fit? That is like the biggest question in my mind. What must they feel and what message are we sending when we suspend them? I think about that for every child, but I really think about that for our earliest learners because this is their first exposure to school. I think about the fact that those parents now think my child is a screw up. What do I do with them? And think about the parents who have their kids suspended several times from several schools. Where do you take them? Where do they go? We don't have a desert island for kids who don't fit, right? So those are the things that I want you to consider as we look at this bill. As we think about the kids who are in those vulnerable positions, who don't understand what's happening to them, we have an opportunity here to send a message that you do belong, you do have worth, you are valued, that there is a place for you to offer what you have to offer. And everybody's best is different. I used to have to tell my kids that all the time. They're like, well, they're not doing their best. You know, we're on a team and they want to win, right? And I said, but everybody's best is different. So I would like for you to consider, as we consider this bill, please think about the children and those vulnerable moments for the kids and the parents. That's all I have.
Thank you so much. Thanks for your testimony. Thank you for your work for kids. We've got Dr. Bernadina Johnson. Was next up. Hello, nice to see you. and after that, it'll be Ms. Abdul, and so you can feel free to come to that other chair. But please, Dr. Johnson, please proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Dr. Bernadia Johnson. I'm assistant professor at Minnesota State University, Mankato, as well as a former superintendent of Minneapolis Public Schools. Before I left Minneapolis Public Schools, I believe in 2013-14, I took the courageous stand to ban suspensions for nonviolent behaviors for students in pre-K through second grade. I took that stand for the very reasons you just heard Ms. Burnside talk about, the fact that school is a place where students belong. They're our littlest learners, and they're learning how to do school. And if you are learning how to do school, then the appropriate response for behaviors is to redirect students and deal them what they need to be able to be successful in the learning environment. And what I can tell you as a part of my work in doing this, it wasn't simply just saying, let's ban suspensions of nonviolent behaviors. It also included me and my academic team once a month looking at every suspension across the entire school district. And after I did that, I thought, what the heck was I thinking? Because it's a lot of work. But it was valuable in that I was able to look at what was happening in schools across the district in early learning programs, as well as what was happening within schools. And what I saw was disturbing. I saw different responses to different students. And I saw that people were pushing students out for behaviors that were rather silly, to be honest. Mm-hmm. So I also have an example that I'd like to share. It's one of a kindergarten girl who was putting on her little chapstick, as little girls do. I didn't, but they put on her lipstick. And the teacher said, put it away. Well, of course, she didn't, because she kept put it on her lips. And the teacher went over and grabbed it from the student. The student got upset, of course, because you took something that belonged to me, and knocked her chair back and ran out of the room and ran down the hall out of the school. She got suspended for being in an unsafe environment and leaving the school environment in the classroom. And I think I would have said to that little girl, honey, I put my lipstick on first thing in the morning and after I eat lunch. So how do we work with students to help them understand what to do when it's appropriate to do it? I also am concerned that we put in huge investments in early childhood, yet we won't get the return on our investment if we are pushing students out of school. And so what we hope to accomplish by giving more access to students, we will not realize that because we are not retaining them and keeping them in school. The other thing that I was able to realize by looking at this data, so I think I'm a sort of expert now because I've looked at data from 100 schools over years. And what I was also able to see is that students were being suspended for things that I wouldn't even think would be the case. But what I heard from my teachers, and I think it's important to know this, that everybody thought this was common sense. This is the right thing to do, Superintendent. And I agreed, of course, and I was glad that everybody agreed. But what they said is, give us some strategies. Help us understand how to do better. Because none of us believe students 4 and 5 should be out of the school in the learning environment. So let us help you, Superintendent. Give us some skills so we can do this work. And so what I would like to leave you with today is that this is important work. You're having the right testimony around the right issues. And I hope to see this maybe expand to other grades. And what I would like to say is that as you're thinking about this, think about every learning center or school that receives state fundings that is responsible for keeping students in schools and accelerating their opportunity to be scholars.
Okay.
Good. I appreciate your time and this opportunity. And if you ever want to call me up for coffee, I do that at the Don Brothers downtown. Okay. But it has to be in my area, and it can't be before 8 o'clock.
Okay, got that.
Yes, yeah.
It's tough enough for us to be meeting at 8 o'clock. So
yes, I know.
Certainly not before 8 o'clock. Thank you, Superintendent, for your leadership for kids. And Ms. Abdul, come on up, and we do have a letter from you as well, I should note, but yeah. Please identify yourself, and then please begin.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I was actually hoping that you guys would meet after 8.
Oh.
494 was brutal. At any rate, I thank you so much again for the opportunity to testify. I do appreciate your time. My name is Aidil Abdul. I have a son who has nonverbal autism. As you may know, autism is a developmental disability that affects the ability to communicate, social skills, sensory and behavior regulation. 1 in 59 children have autism nationwide, and 1 in 26 children have autism in Minnesota, according to Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. That they funded sites, which include Minnesota. There are 11 sites. My son, who does not understand cause-effect and is profoundly affected by autism, was suspended by Principal Jason Anderson in Bloomington Public Schools. I will never forget that day. This happened because it has profoundly affected me, his father, and her family emotionally, mentally, physically, and financially. The right to not be discriminated against based on race, color, and national origin are supposed to be guaranteed by the Civil Rights of 1964. This same right was extended to students with disabilities under the IDEA Act of 2004. Yet, students of color and students with disabilities are disproportionately disciplined. There are many reasons for this, as so many before me have eloquently stated. But one that stands out for me is implicit bias. And I'd like to share with you research. Ever since May 3rd of 2018 at 5:18 p.m. when my son was suspended, I have read more research than if I was a PhD student, I kid you not, about suspensions, about disparity, about education. And I am baffled by what I see. I'm heartbroken by what I see. Researchers at Yale University investigated and found that when subjects were asked to watch a video of children, black boy, black girl, white boy, white girl, displaying challenging behaviors, teachers gazed longer at black children, especially black boys. The severity of the discipline was also higher when the race of the student and the teacher did not match. Teachers were watching black boys longer and waiting and expecting the worst of them. This is research, not my opinion. And I want you to think about this for a minute. A recent analysis by the Star Tribune also stated that while students of color have grown to be 34% in Minnesota, teachers of color are only 5%. Sadly, our students are paying for the price of this. Minnesota has a shameful, and I want to repeat, shameful discipline racial disparity. I've lived in many states. Obviously, I'm from Somalia. I've lived in many other countries and other continents. And the land of 10,000 lakes has amazing things. And even though in the winter I move in my mind, but when spring comes, it's really fantastic place to live. But we are failing children who look like me, not because they do things worse or not because they don't understand or not because they're less, but simply because of the color of their skin or because they're disabled. I think that's something that we have to be ashamed of. We need to change this trajectory so that a child is a child is a child, irrespective of his or her race, ethnicity, color, or disability. Parents, including me, send their children to school to learn and be nurtured. When children are kicked out of school, we are telling them, as you so eloquently said, that they are not important enough. We are telling their families that. That's what the message I got from Bloomington Public Schools, that I wasn't important enough. You know, they say insanity is doing the same thing and expecting different results. Minnesota must do something different. I think this legislation is the right step. It's the right first step. It doesn't go far enough, in my humble little opinion. I would even add required implicit bias training for educators. I am also hopeful and confident that we will decrease and hopefully eliminate this horrible statistic for the sake of our children. Children are not perfect. They learn. They make mistakes. Neither are adults. And the goal is to teach each child to the best of their ability in not just academics, but also to become a productive member of society. I thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Abdul. Thank you. I think we're going to move to member questions. We're trying to, we've got a couple more bills we're going to try to get to this morning. So member questions, and Representative Wasilewicz first on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Richardson, for bringing this bill forward to us. I don't want to downplay the disparities, but I do have some concerns about requiring school districts not to dismiss, and I'll just share a story about why. I work in a school-based child care program, and we have a preschool program as part of that program, and we have had instances where we've had students who are harming other students and staff, and I'm just concerned that I think our schools are not prepared to handle that, first of all, which is a separate issue. But I'm concerned that if we don't have this as an option, that we're going to have other students who are losing opportunities to be in school. When we have students who are showing this behavior, whether it's a good policy or not, we oftentimes have the entire classroom having to leave the classroom while the student is engaging in behavior. And so I just want to express that, not saying I won't support the bill, but I think that that, for me, is a concern that's kind of stuck in the back of my mind.
Representative Richardson, any response?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, the scope of this bill is really thinking about our youngest learners and thinking about preschoolers. And part of the conversation that needs to be had related to dismissals is also looking at ensuring that there's support for teachers and that there's resources for teachers and that there's training as well, to think of what those alternatives to dismissal can look like. And so I really see this as a first step. It's an opportunity to begin a conversation. And I've worked with school districts across the state of Minnesota, and there's a pathway forward to do this that is safe for schools and also supportive of students of color and students with disabilities.
Representative Wasilewicz, anything else? Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if maybe you could, if you have had those conversations, have you heard things that other districts are doing that have been helpful? And so if this is a policy that moves forward, that school districts can actually do this, but also protect the safety of other students and staff in the classroom. I don't know if you've had those discussions or can share some ideas.
Representative Richardson.
Part of the issue, especially when we're talking about students with disabilities, especially students with invisible disabilities, oftentimes symptoms of those disabilities are being labeled as behavioral issues. And so I think an important part of this is being able to recognize the neurodiversity of students and understanding that those symptoms require accommodation and support. And I think that when you think about the spectrum of discipline overall, if you're talking about a risk of harm to someone versus the situations that we've heard about as well of simply just being disruptive, there's a whole spectrum in terms of reasons that kids are being dismissed. And I've been struck by the number of dismissals that are really for things that don't make a lot of sense, including the chapstick story that we just heard, or this idea of being too loud in class or talking too loudly in class. There have been dismissals related to that. And so I think that we really have to look at the entire spectrum of what's going on. And one of the really important challenges when we see disparities of people being 8 times more likely to be suspended or 10 times more likely, there is no research that says that American Indian children are 10 times more likely to be disruptive in class than others. And when you look at that based upon their rates in terms of demographics of the state, it makes no sense that you would have that level of disparity that's related to race. And I think that that needs to be part of the conversation as well.
Okay, thank you. Representative Katisa Witun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Richardson, for bringing forward this bill. So I am a preschool parent. I have 2 little boys, 3K and 4K, and my boys are biracial. So, I mean, when we look at some of the racial and ethnic disparities, this is something that's personal to me and my family. It's concerning. I mean, it's, you know, we see the data ongoing in Minnesota. Excuse me. And I do think that we need to take steps to stem that issue. I do have concern about some of the violent actions that 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds might take, not necessarily against teachers specifically, but against other students in the classroom. So I think it, you know, it might be worth exploring some language, potentially an amendment as we go forward with this, just to make sure that if there is an ongoing violence issue happening, that we are taking steps to address that. Additionally, we know that we have a cross subsidy issue in special education, K through 12. This is impacting our preschool students as well. And so being in the enviable position of being a policy and finance committee, we can hopefully take some steps to make sure that we're giving our school districts the support that they need in order to increase assistance for those special ed students who might not be getting the help, and the teachers who might not be getting all the training that they need to keep these students in the school and avoid issues of violence and those types of things.
Thank you, Representative Khadija Witun. We have there's one member of the public who very much wanted to testify, and we'll have this woman in the yellow scarf, I believe. And I'm going to ask you to keep things. If you are interested, come on over and come up to the testifiers table. I'll ask you to keep your remarks pretty quick if you can, and then we're going to move on, members and members of the public, to our final two bills. But if you can identify yourself, and then please proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. My name is Marika Pfeffercorn. I am the co-chair of the Solutions Not Suspensions Coalition. We are a group of about 20 organizations plus individuals that represent families, youth, parents, students, and community members that have been directly impacted by suspension. And we also focus on creating the conditions in schools so that we can have successful engagement around learning. We are completely in support of this bill here before you today, and want to thank you for actually taking the time to have this hearing. We've been up at the state capitol for over 4 years trying to promote the Student Inclusion and Engagement Act, and to finally get some traction is very significant for our parents and families that have been coming down here to talk with you all. We just really want to reiterate that this is a very personal issue, and we're talking about young people that are at this time shaping and forming their relationship with education and learning. And because of that, we need to have them in the classroom. And whether it's providing additional supports in the classroom to make sure that our young people can stay there, this sets a precedent that we have a priority of our children from the earliest stages really being committed to that learning. And that needs to be demonstrated by us by showing that, first of all, you get a second chance and you continue to come back. Because a lot of our families in preschool, once or twice, and they're off the record and they're asked to leave. And so there's not as much ability to track what's happening in the earlier ages. And so just even by having this in place, we'll get a better sense of what's happening in the classroom. What I also want to emphasize is that we want this to be completely expanded, and that in addition to that, this is headed in the right direction, but it really needs to apply to all and any early learning that receives public dollars. And that is critical for us as we move this and advance this forward, because this really encompasses a lot of different settings or where young people are experiencing pushout. Again, the coalition has been here for a significant amount of time. I have been personally impacted across multiple school districts in the state, working with families and folks within my own family that have been pushed out and shut out. So, again, I thank you for listening, hearing the testimony, and the Solutions Not Suspensions Coalition is here to work with you in the future.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your testimony and your work. So, Representative Richardson, you get the last word. I should have done that on your past bill. On your prior bill,
pardon me. I will just ask for support. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good. Thanks so much, Representative Richardson. So with that, I will lay House File 1785 over for possible inclusion in the division report as amended. Thank you. Lay it over House File 1785 as amended. Representative Hassan, let's bring you up, and then we'll end with Representative Joachim's bill. House File 1653, and if we can have a motion to put that bill in front of us for possible inclusion in a division report.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So moved.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. Representative Hassan, and I don't see any amendment. And so as you settle in, there is no amendment. So then if you can please describe your bill. Oh, okay. Well, there are treats. There you go. All right. So Representative Heitzman did work out. Representative Hassan, and as members, as I've said, we'll get to this, and then Chair Joachim, we want to make sure to get her in and out this morning as well. So, Representative Hassan, to your bill.
Good morning, everyone, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Today we have House File 1653. It's relating to the North Star Care. And what we're asking is modifying the North Star Care for children benefits under the age of 6 years old. I don't know if everyone is familiar with North Star Care, but I have brought testifiers and experts.
Okay.
We'll start with Mary Boo, who's going to be our first testifier.
Good. So please identify yourself and then begin.
Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you, Representative Hassan. My name is Mary Boo. I'm with the North American Council on Adoptable Children, and we work to ensure that all children in foster care have families and that adoptive families have the support they need to help their children heal and thrive. In Minnesota, we support about 2,000 adoptive, foster, and kinship families. And I'm here to ask for a fix to North Star Care, a fix that's also supported by Catholic Charities, Aspire Minnesota, and the Minnesota chapter of the National Association of Social Workers.
Can I ask you to pull the microphone just a little closer to you, please?
Of course. Is that better?
That is better. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Children in foster care are wonderful kids. They are some of the strongest and most resilient children you'll ever meet. They're in care because they've experienced abuse and neglect, and the government has taken responsibility for them. These children have often been exposed to drugs and alcohol in utero and violence in their early lives. The trauma they've experienced affects them in many lifelong ways, including their physical and mental health, their behaviors, and more. In recognition of these challenges, Minnesota, like every other state, provides support to children in foster care. And when the children the state considers special need go to adoption and guardianship with relatives, the support continues. Before 2015, Minnesota adopted children received only half of the support they received in foster care, even though the children's needs didn't change with adoption. Passed in 2015, North Star Care for Children was designed to fix that, to equalize support for children in foster, adoptive, and guardianship families. But the final bill only equalized that support for children who are six and older, leaving children adopted under age six with only half of the support they received in foster care. In fact, North Star made things worse for these children because before 2015, the children were able to get respite care or child care. They are no longer able to receive those additional services. I want to give a simple example. A five-year-old Gus and six-year-old Carolina are in foster care. The state looks at their disabilities and makes a determination about the support they need, represented by these shoes. Six-year-old Carolina is adopted, and she gets to keep these shoes throughout her childhood. But Gus, adopted at age five, the state takes back one of the shoes, and he and his family get to limp along with half the support as long as he's a child, even though he has the same needs as Carolina and other children adopted at age six and older. With younger children, more serious needs may not even become apparent until they enter school or later. Even if the state determines the child requires more support, they will always receive only half of what they would have gotten if they were adopted at age six or older. I want to share just one story. Charlie is a little boy who entered care when he was very young. He was placed with his grandparents, and they adopted him when he was four. His grandfather, Glenn, was a Hennepin County social worker who retired. He and his wife hadn't planned on raising another child, but they're doing it because it's right for Charlie. But they struggle daily to meet his needs now because he receives only half of the support he received in foster care. His needs are not half of what they were in foster care. And stories like Charlie's are everyday stories in Minnesota, where more than 50% of the children are adopted under age six, many by relatives. When it removed children from their birth parents, Minnesota made a commitment to ensuring that their needs would be met. Passing this bill is an important step on the path to honoring that commitment.
Thank you for your testimony and for your work. So then, Representative Hassan, your next testifier looks like maybe sitting to the right there. If you can please identify yourself and begin.
My name is Hannah Leader, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Since the North Star system was implemented in 2015, we have adopted three children from foster care and are in the process of finalizing permanency on the fourth. This was definitely not our plan going into our golden years to be raising four young children with less than 3 years from retirement. But with the incredible challenges of raising them comes an incredible amount of love. Before adopting, we asked ourselves, what could possibly be more important than providing a home for traumatized, abused, and needy foster children? For us, nothing. It is our highest and best calling, and we are greatly blessed. But I don't want to sugarcoat the difficulty of our decision. Our children have been diagnosed with fetal alcohol syndrome, several different mental health diagnoses, neurological behavior and sleep disorders, sensory processing disorder, learning disabilities, and asthma. The reality of dealing with these demanding and difficult issues every day, 24 hours a day, can be very challenging and stressful. I have only had one full night of sleep in the past 5 years, and many times I'm up multiple times a night. Raging emotions, violent outbursts, epic meltdowns, frustrated learning disabilities that are hard for me to understand are a normal part of our everyday. Sometimes we have to leave places or events early. Sometimes I feel judged by the negative behavior of our children in public. Sometimes I want to cry out to the people watching as my three-year-old screams and physically attacks me. Please understand this is not his fault. And it's not. These children are victims. Victims of abuse, neglect, trauma, and drug and alcohol exposure. And the problems are generational. Our children's birth mothers were foster children themselves, and they were abused. Their mothers died young from drug and alcohol abuse and violence on the streets. Our birth mother told me she is glad her children are with us because they are happy. She is anything but happy. We want to give our children the best chance to develop to their full potential, to have a happy and healthy and satisfying life, and to break the cycle of foster care involvement. This takes support and investment in adoptive families and children. I know how much more we could do for our children if we receive full adoption assistance, and this will become even more critical when we retire and our income is limited and their needs will be greater. Foster children deserve our best. The state has the incredible power to remove children from their birth parents and place them with another family.
It is a sad, tragic end to their removal when birth parents lose their children permanently. This thought is with me, and it motivates me to go the extra mile to meet our children's many needs. This committee understands the importance of investing in the early years to improve the outcome of children's lives. Please help us improve our children's lives by fully supporting adoptive families. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony and for your work. And so it looks like, Representative Hassan, you have another testifier. So, ma'am, please identify yourself and begin.
Good morning, and I'd like to say thank you, Chair, members, and thank you, Member Hassan. My name is Lucy Favorite. I'm an enrolled member of the White Earth Indian Reservation. I'm the executive director of a nonprofit child foster care agency called American Indian Family and Children Services, or AFACS. As a nonprofit, we can license in all 87 counties. AFACS opened its doors in 1985 to provide culturally specific foster homes for Indian children needing short-term placement. Once licensed, foster parents have access to AFACS staff 24/7, and during placement, visits are made monthly to see how we can support. I don't think that I need to speak to the harm that is done once a child is removed and placed in foster care. What complicates this further is when the child is moved multiple times. While our agency fully supports family contact and reunification, in some cases this isn't always possible. This is where the county or tribe has to work to identify a family member that can be a permanency option for the child. When these resources are exhausted, the counties and tribes look elsewhere. It's not uncommon to look to the foster home where the child is currently placed as a permanency option. By providing permanency for a child at a younger age, we can maybe head off some of the physical, developmental, and or mental health issues that can come with placement away from a child's biological family. While there's no predicting the future, the more a foster family knows of a child's history ahead of time, the better able they are to parent and care for the child. We all know how expensive it is to raise a child. When you have a child that has a disability or significant needs, that dollar amount is only going to go up. Once a foster family opts to take a child permanently, they are on their own. Often the money received is cut in half. I have worked with families that were not given any financial compensation after adopting. I have worked with grandparents, great-grandparents, and other relatives that are struggling to be able to provide for these little ones. These are people that should be enjoying their retirement years, and instead they are left financially struggling to be able to care for their relatives. We ask that you support and keep the compensation the same for a child once permanency is in place. And I would like to say Miigwech, that's thank you, and Ojibwe, for your time today.
Thank you so much for your testimony and for your work. Are there any other testifiers from you, Representative Hassan?
No.
Okay. And any members of the public who wish to testify for or against the bill? Not seeing anyone. So member questions. Representative Wasilewicz.
Thank
and
you.
I am hoping the next couple of minutes we'll move on to the next bill. But
thank you, Mr. Chair. I just I don't see a fiscal note attached. I just am wondering if there's any idea of what all of this might cost, because I don't know anything about the program right now.
Representative Hassan, or maybe that Mr. Berg is aware of, can provide us background on that. Why don't we go to him and then
Representative. Mr. Chair, Representative Wasilewicz, there is a pending fiscal note that has not been completed. As soon as it is, I'll distribute it.
Thank you very much. Yeah, thank you. It looks like we have that. And then Representative Katiza-Witun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Hassan, for bringing this bill forward. Thank you for our testifiers for the work that you do in supporting our state's most vulnerable children. I am a current licensed foster parent in Hennepin County. We're working to adopt our three children, who are five and under. And I'm just hopeful, Ms. Boo, could you clarify? I understand as a foster parent going into the process that, your assistance rate is sort of set, but then if some of the challenges that your child might be facing as they grow that haven't necessarily come to light, you can go back in and kind of request a reassessment. Mm-hmm. How does that work? And did you say that the child still only receives half of that increased payment if the reassessment is approved?
Ms. Bowie.
Yes, thank you. Yes, so you can go back and ask for renegotiation, and in Minnesota there's a very, each state is different, Minnesota has a very structured process for if you have this disability or this, you get a certain rate. Children, and so you can go back and request that, and if the state has the proper documentation, they can grant that, yes, you fit this higher rate. But if the child was adopted under age six, they will still get only 50% of what the state has determined a child with those needs should get. So again, no matter what, you know, no matter how disabled they are, no matter how difficult it is, as long as they were adopted under age six, they can never get the full amount that a child who's adopted an older age would get or a child who stays in foster care would get.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other member questions at all? And seeing none, so then Representative Hassan will give you the last word on your bill.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I ask for your support. We all know and love children, and we care what happens to children. We want to make sure that the decisions that we're making today will have positive impact on a young children tomorrow. I ask for your support.
Thank you so much, Representative Hassan, and to your testifiers as well. And with that, I will lay over House File 1653 for possible inclusion in a division report. And Chair Joachim, you are up. And welcome to our committee. And now for some reason I don't have the, what's the bill number? It is 1582. May I have a motion to put House File 1582 before us for possible inclusion division report?
So moved.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. And so Chair Joachim, again, welcome and please describe your bill when you're ready. And this will be, and by the way, members of the public, this will be our final bill we'll be addressing this morning. The remaining bills on the calendar we'll be addressing this afternoon. This evening. Might be this afternoon, floor session is short. But in any case, we'll get to that at the end. Chair Joachim.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, and thank you. Ed Policy is going to try not to meet this evening. So
yeah.
I'll make sure you guys have your staff. So I want to thank you so much, and thank you for being here early in the morning. I have a tax committee at 8 a.m. Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, so I feel your pain. And I know you have a busy agenda, so good morning. Thank you for hearing House File 1582. That would appropriate money for the Parent-Child Home Program. I'm joined here today by Jewish Family and Children's Services, JFCS. They provide a broad range of social services for people of all ages and backgrounds. In 2006, JFCS was working in the St. Louis Park Elementary Schools right in their backyard. They quickly saw a critical need for a new early childhood center intervention centered around access to quality early learning opportunities, especially for low-income families. JFCS searched for programs with proven outcomes and selected the Parent-Child Home Program. There are proven outcomes from children in the PCHP program compared to their socioeconomic peers are pretty amazing. They're 50% more likely to be ready for kindergarten, 50% less likely to be referred to special ed services by third grade, and 30% more likely to graduate from high school. Once the JFCS started the PCHP program, it quickly grew to meet a regional need. And now, the Promised Neighborhood of Central Minnesota has reached out to partner with JFCS to bring PCHP to St. Cloud. They're currently in the planning process. What you see in House File 1582 is an increase to the program-based funding to make this expansion a reality. I have a few folks here today to explain the benefits and describe the program, and that is Judy Helper. She's the CEO of Jewish Family and Children's Services of Minneapolis, Christy Murray, Parent-Child Home Program Manager, and John Smith, Executive Committee from Promised Neighborhood in Central Minnesota. So I have asked them to be brief, so that there'll be time for questions, and great. I will turn it over.
Okay, please identify yourself for the record and then begin.
Committee Chair Pinto and Chief Sponsor Representative Joachim, thank you for having us this morning. I'm Judy Helper, CEO at Jewish Family and Children's Service of Minneapolis. The introduction that you just heard is pretty comprehensive, and I'll just go into a little more detail before turning it over to our other speakers this morning. JFCS, as Representative Joachim mentioned, didn't make this program, design this program, but we did bring it to Minnesota. It's an international program which has been around since the 1960s, and we brought it to Minnesota in 2006. And this program really caught our attention because of its early intervention, starting with children as young as 18 months. It's literacy-based, it's home-based, and we thought that it was the answer to ensuring that we could respond to the opportunity gap in Minnesota and preparing some of our most vulnerable children for school success. What caught our attention about this program was both its simplicity and its outcomes. In terms of simplicity, it is a visit to a family's home twice a week for 30 weeks for 2 years. And at the first visit each week, a family is given a book or a toy, something that is found commonly in middle-class homes, and that becomes a vehicle for bringing language into the home. The designer of this program, the person who launched it, was able to quickly ascertain that what divided low-income and low-educated children from their middle-class peers was the availability of language. Language is what develops the brain. Brain development is what ensures school success. So we were excited about this program. We started with 18 families in 2006, and today, thanks to the support we received from the state of Minnesota, we're now serving 300 families. We are in Cass and Crow Wing counties, and we're looking forward to extending our program into southern Minnesota, and we're looking at some sites currently. 100% of our families are living at or below the 200% poverty guidelines, and 91% of our families are families of color. 41% of the families we serve are Somali, 10% are from other African countries. 18% of the families we serve are Hispanic or Latino, and 11% are African American. And one of the great pleasures of our program is that having done it for so many years, some of our graduate parents are now the home visitors, and so they speak and represent the countries that they come from, and giving our program even greater success with families being able to identify with those that are there to help. I could go on, but I'm going to, as you can tell, I've been speaking very quickly and trying to be brief. At this point, it's my pleasure to turn the microphone over to John Smith, Executive Director of Promise Neighborhood from Central Minnesota.
Thank you so much. Mr. Smith, please identify yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Chairman Pinto and committee members. My name is John Smith. I'm the chair of the executive committee at Promise Neighborhood of Central Minnesota. We are located in St. Cloud, Minnesota, in southeast St. Cloud. We serve two elementary schools primarily. The poverty rate is 90% at the two schools. There's over 800 kids. And we only hire from the community that we serve. We want to bring this program to Promise Neighborhood and St. Cloud. There's a couple of reasons. One, you've heard the testimonies today about how some of our children are struggling academically in the early years, not being prepared. Underneath of that, families aren't involved. And this program gives us an opportunity to support our parents, our families, and our communities as first teachers and educators. It also gives us the opportunity to provide leadership and economic opportunities for the community that we serve. Again, we only hire from the target community. And lastly, we have been able to develop a great partnership with Jewish Family and Children's Services. Their mission is very similar in terms of inclusion, early childhood learning, and supportive services. And we would greatly appreciate it if you supported the bill.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Smith. Thanks for your testimony. And now we have a parent representative, I believe. So please identify yourself. No?
This is Christy Murray, and she is the program director.
Program director.
Yep.
I misheard Chair Joachim before. My apologies.
Yes. So here's Christy Murray.
Yeah, please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Committee Chair Pinto and committee members. As you're getting to see these fun books and toys that are going around, these are things that you would find in the family's homes. And you can see that they are... They represent different languages. We're able to provide this program in English, Spanish, Somali, Hmong, and we do have staff that also are able to use American Sign Language as well, too, because we want to create a rich language environment in the home. And although often our program focuses on the adorable children that get to be in this program and the books and toys that are in the home, we also are deeply connecting with our parents and helping them to be empowered, and to, we're looking at the family's strengths and then connecting them to resources. And connection to resources is much more than just providing information. Often our families have need more help in identifying what barriers that they have in actually accessing the resources, accessing the school system. And through our work, what is unique about our work, when we're meeting with families twice a week for 2 years, we're building these trusting relationships where parents are able to open up and let us know about what barriers they might have. We're able to help provide them the empowerment and the encouragement to be able to overcome some of those barriers. And many of our families that that we're working with, these parents may also not have had a positive experience in school too, and what we're able to do through this program is to really help them to develop their ability to be their child's educational advocate for the rest of their lives too, so that when they enter into the school system, they're ready to be able to support all of the children that would be in their home. And this this house file would allow us to be able to provide 30 additional families each year. We are already in the works of getting St. Cloud ready to start seeing families in the coming weeks. And we are hearing out from other places in Minnesota as well, too. Northfield and Faribault and Rochester are other places that we're exploring some potential partners that are wanting to see this program in their community as well, too.
I just want to say a word about results and then take questions. I just want to say for every $1 that is spent on this program, the return on investment to the state of Minnesota is $4.40. And to society, it's $9.50. And I also want to mention that in terms of our outcome reports to the Minnesota Department of Education, we've been able to establish that we have overreached our goal of 85%, reporting 93% of the children that are participating demonstrated age-appropriate development within six domains as measured by the ASQ and the ASQ-SE developmental screening tool. And our goal is 80% for families showing an increase in parent-child communication techniques that promote language literacy skills of children.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Helper. Any other testifiers, Chair Joachim, for you?
No, Mr. Chair, thank you.
Okay. And any members of the public wish to testify for or against? And not seeing any. We'll move to member questions. I have just a couple things I want to clarify. The as it occurs to me, the starting at 16 months, language acquisition starts so early. What is the reason for starting at that? At that age, Ms. Halver, Ms. Murray, or somebody else?
Sure.
Yeah, thanks.
As Judy Helper mentioned, this is a research-based program, and what they found is that is the time when verbal language is happening for the child. We can start as young as 16 months, and where we see our program a lot, too, is that there is a lot of home visiting programs that are already going out to see families prenatally to 2 years old, and then that's where we get a lot of our referrals as well, too, because they see that there's families that are needing that added support. And so we're able to be that bridge of connection to keep that learning process happening.
Okay. Good. Ms. Helper, yeah, please.
Thank you. Just to add that we operate a bit as a franchisee, if you will, and as such, we have to do this program with absolute fidelity to the home office,
right.
And that's how they measure the results and make sure that our results are being measured accurately with all the other states that participate in this program. And so we can't start sooner. We have to start when the program says, and for the reason that you just heard Christy mention.
And I guess that's connected to the evidence. It's an evidence-based program,
correct.
Right? So the evidence has been validated for that particular age range.
That
okay,
thank you.
And as I understand, the base funding has been $1.8 million, but then this would be an increase of $300,000. Representative France, or somebody, yeah, Representative Franson. Yeah,
thank
please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
So we have home visiting programs run through the Department of Education, and we have ECFE. How does your program differ from what we currently have as well run through the state? And are your results different?
Ms. Halper or Ms. Murray. Yeah.
I'd be happy to answer. We actually get a large number of our referrals come from the early childhood family education programs and early childhood special education programs in all of the school districts that we're working with, because the families that we are working with are being identified that they're needing more support, that they're, we eliminate any barriers to transportation. We eliminate a lot of language issues as well, too, because we're able to provide the home visits in that language without having to use interpreting services. We're able to have a much higher dosage, which is what those families are needing, to be able to have that twice a week for 2 years, being able to provide that that trusting relationship that happens between the parent, between the parents and the child and the early learning specialist who's coming out to provide those services. And so we work in partnership with ECFE and ECSE.
Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it sounds like it's a little bit more comprehensive than what is run through the Department of Education or possibly ECFE. Is that correct? Would that be a good
It's very much individualized as well, too, because we have our structure of our providing the book or toy as a tool to increase the verbal interaction, but we're also looking at what those families' needs are, because we know that we actually proctor the ASQs, and we can modify our visits to be able to help build on skills that kids are needing to build. We are culturally responsive and grounded, and so we are working within that context too. As Judy mentioned earlier, 91% of the families that we're working with are families who are families of color, many of them who have historical trauma or recent trauma that are coming as refugees and immigrants to this community as well too, and so we're able to provide trauma-informed care when we're working with them as well.
It actually, Representative Franson, it's interesting your question, because I've been talking with folks in the program, understand, because this is a home visiting program, and of course then we have a home visiting program and funding through Department of Health. So one thing that I've been trying to think through and talk through is, to what extent is this connected with those programs, and just to think about that, because you've got home visiting programs, and is it distinct enough to sort of think of it in those different departments? So anyway, Representative Franson.
And thank you for the correction, because I did mean to say Department of Health, but for some reason my mind is on education today.
Oh, yeah.
your program does come highly recommended. I think there was a representative in my office last year regarding the program. And no, I think just throughout the Capitol, it comes with high remarks. So thank you.
Yeah, no, it sure does. Yeah, thank you, Representative Franson. Any other member questions? Oh, Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So not for this year and the funding, but any idea about, you know, if there were more money available, how much need is still out there that we're not reaching? A lot. I mean, it's a lot. Okay. But so, but can you give us an idea of that as we think to the future of if it's working, if we keep documenting that this makes a difference and it's closing these gaps that we need to close so that kids are school ready and succeeding in school, especially new immigrant groups coming in, experiencing trauma. You know, if this is something that works, what would the future bring if we could actually fund it the way that made a difference?
Yeah, absolutely.
Ms. Murray.
Great question. I mean, as you can see, we're serving 311 families, but we know that there's many more than 311 families that are living in poverty in Minnesota. And so we definitely could see that this program we would love to see this in every community in Minnesota. And one of the nice things about this program is because it is, as Judy said, kind of like a franchise style, we have a set way about how in different communities that this could work. And so we know what the structure is for the staffing. We know the training, and Jewish Family and Children's Services is taking the lead to ensure the fidelity of the training of this program, and how to best work to be able to start programs in new fields.
And Chair Joachim.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I think Mr. Smith might have something to add about why they wanted to reach out from St. Cloud to be part of this.
Okay. I'll hand off to Mr. Smith.
For 5 years, I've worked in an elementary school. And we have focused on kids starting in second and third grade. And based on what we have seen, the challenges that our kids are having with behavior, attendance, and academics, this program will give us the ability to start working with kids before they reach kindergarten. And again, especially in our community, I think in St. Cloud, 50% of the students are low income. In the neighborhood that we serve, it's 90%. And we know that most of those kids will end up having those challenges, and we're able to support the family because kids don't live in a vacuum. We need to provide for family support, and we need to exercise some of the family value systems that we use in central Minnesota and across Minnesota to inform our programming as well.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Ms.
Helper, yeah, briefly if you can.
Yes, very briefly. Yeah. Just to say, one of the things that makes this program so powerful is also that it is intended to be transformational. That's the word that they use. And so a family that receives this service gets it once. It's a two-year program with a promise that the transformation that occurs during that two-year time will prepare parents for subsequent children and for children who are in the home that are older than 18 months to 3 years. We measure two things: school readiness for the identified child for whom the program is being brought into the home, and greater confidence and skill for the parents. And we measure that by their ability to go on to greater school training, advance in their careers, and greater confidence in their home. So it's a two-year investment that lasts a lifetime for these families and subsequent and other children.
Thank you so much. Representative Chair Joaquin, please.
I'll just do closing comments. I just want to thank Mr. Chair and members for the discussion and your time and your attention to this morning. At PCHP helps parents connect with their children and to become more engaged in their education before they hit kindergarten, as Mr. Smith said. And we know that once a parent is engaged in their child's education, their future is so much brighter. So members, I ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you so much, you. Madam Chair, and testifiers. Thank you. And with that, I will lay over House File 1582 for possible inclusion in division report. I have to rush over to be at a committee meeting that I can't be too late for. So if anybody needs to talk to me afterwards, you may have to jog with me or else connect with me later. We will be recessing to the call of the chair. I expect we'll be in room 400 North, and it'll be quite shortly after session ends, and so please keep an eye out for your email and note that we're adding sessions next week because we are really under the crunch now. So with that, members, we are in recess to the call of the chair. Right, I'm not gaveling. All right, we're in recess to the call of the chair. No gaveling. Thank you so much.
I'll do that just in case. We are reconvening the House Early Childhood Finance and Policy Division, and we will be moving on to our next bill, which is House File 2264. Which is Representative Wasilewicz, her bill. And Representative Wasilewicz, you are moving this bill for possible inclusion in a division report. That is your motion, correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that is the motion.
Okay. I want to make sure our microphones are all on. I'm sure we're being recorded. Okay. And so, Representative Wasilewicz, please describe your bill.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee,
I guess you do.
House File 2264 creates the Retaining Early Educators Through Retaining Incentives Now grant program to provide competitive grants to incentivize well-trained childcare professionals to stay in the workforce. And DHS allocates these grant funds to childcare resource and referral agencies to administer the program. I work in childcare, school-based childcare. I know that we have faced concerns with finding staff and keeping staff. And so this is some funds that will help child care programs retain qualified staff.
Okay, turn things over to your first testifier, and yeah, please make sure you're recorded, and please identify yourself, and then please proceed.
I sure can. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Anne McCulley, and I serve as Executive Director of Child Care Aware of Minnesota. We are the agency, a nonprofit agency, that coordinates the activities of the statewide Child Care Aware system, which is also known as the Child Care Resource and Referral System. Our agency is the administrative home to the Retain Grant Program, which is under discussion tonight. I also serve on the Minnesota Transforming the Workforce Birth Through 8 work group, and that is a group which is trying to look at ways to implement the recommendations of the National Academy of Services report of that same name, and I believe there's a letter from that organization in your packets.
And Ms. McCulley, could I just confirm? That's the group that we heard from a bit at the presentation in St. Cloud as
correct.
Well.
Many of us were there last Friday in the blizzard to talk
yes,
with you.
Yes, and provided some information about the recommendations. Yeah, please continue.
Thank you. I also am chairing currently a work group, rather, that's out of the National Teach Early Childhood Scholarship Center, looking at the question very specifically of compensation. And that's another place that we are looking at this question of the retained grant. That work group is building on the work of the National Governors Association report in Minnesota on strategies for compensation. So lots of different organizations and people interested in this bill. As you've heard through testimony in this committee many times, the early childhood field is challenged by poor wages and high turnover. Both problems reduce the quality of care that children receive. The retained grant program started in 2006 as an attempt to address these issues. It's designed in part on workforce retention programs in other states, and it helps providers in both licensed family child care homes and in center-based settings who've been working full-time for at least 1 year in their position. Awardees must have completed a CDA certificate, an associate, bachelor's, or master's degree in early childhood or a related field. The program offers a small bonus to these professionals who are staying in the field despite low wages and who continually take time for their own professional growth. In return, the grant recipient agrees to remain working in their current position for an additional year. We offer two different retained bonuses each year, one for centers and one for family child care providers. And bonuses are awarded to each group, which range from $500 to $3,500, depending on their level of education or what we know as their career lattice step. These can be used to cover professional or personal expenses to improve a program's bottom line. They really are meant to be, they're awarded to the most qualified applicants as funds allow, and they really are meant to help them basically make up that lack of compensation and to keep them in the field. Other elements that help providers earn to qualify for these grants include years of service in the field, participation in Parent Aware, additional training beyond licensure recommendations or requirements, involvement in the professional association, service as a consultant or mentor to other providers, and programs that care for infants and toddlers. Since this is also trying to address compensation, the lower the salary of the provider, the more points they get on their application. So finally, I'll just speak to in a recent evaluation of the retained program by the research firm Child Trends, 92% of surveyed recipients indicated that the retained bonus was enough to help them, even in a small way, and about half agreed that receiving a bonus influenced their decision to remain in the workforce. Surveyed recipients most commonly describe these funds as helpful for purchasing goods and resources, either for personal use or for their child care program. And as Representative Roslick mentioned, the core funding for this program since its inception has come from the Child Care and Development Block Grant, most specifically the quality set-aside dollars. When this program was launched, there were some additional private funds from foundations and through the local Minnesota Initiative Foundations to launch it, but there's never been a state funding commitment to this program. And so we feel that with some additional funds, and you've got some information in your packet about the current funding and the current participation, we know we've sometimes had to turn away as many as two-thirds of qualified candidates. And so with additional funds in the pool, this could be continue to be one more tool in the toolbox that helps us get our arms around this issue of retention and compensation. And we do have one more witness.
Okay, and please, listen to the slide of the microphone, and please identify yourself for the record, and then please begin.
My name is Cheryl Cullough, and I am a family child care provider here in the state of Minnesota.
Please.
As I mentioned, I am a licensed family child care provider for the past 16 years in Eden Prairie, Minnesota. I am also a four-star rated Parent Aware program, as well as being accredited by the National Association of Family Child Care. The retained funding is extremely important to many providers. As you know, I work in a field that is not highly compensated. Providing and maintaining a high-quality program is important to the families that I serve, as it provides them with the safe comfort knowing that their child is being well taken care of and providing quality learning experiences to learn and grow and be ready for the kindergarten school year. Providers spend between 50 and 60 hours a week in providing direct quality care to families. In addition, we spend our own family time in the evenings and weekends to go grocery shopping, shopping for crafts and supplies, shopping for materials such as toys and equipment, researching field trips, preparing lesson plans, looking for resources that can assist my families who are in need of services, and also attending classes to add to my own professional development. This past year alone for me, I spent well over 600 hours in professional development in the early childhood field, mostly in large to finish my master's degree in early childhood. Receiving this retained funding this year is truly a big incentive for me. It shows me an appreciation and dedication that I so seldom receive. One way that I choose to spend this money is helping support my education. and also to buy equipment for, also to replace and buy some equipment in my family child care program. Please support this bill. There needs to be an investment in retain so that providers can feel appreciated, compensated for their long hours of hard work to provide quality care, but also to support us in our commitment to providing that quality care for families across the Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Wasilewicz, any other testifiers from you? Okay. We'll have, what do we have, any members of the public? Is anyone who wishes to testify for or against the bill? And then we'll move on to member questions. I see anybody come up. So questions from members. Anybody has Representative Pryor.
Mr. Chair, and I'm sorry, I didn't jot down your name. I apologize.
No problem.
So you talked about the number of people that you had to turn away. Do you have any data or even anecdotal information about people that did not get a grant or retained grants? What happened afterwards?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pryor, we unfortunately, given the small size of the program, tracking particularly folks who did not receive a grant is not usually in our purview. We always encourage people to try again. Right now, because of the limitation on funds, we actually allow people only to receive the grant every other year, so that even draws it out further. So if they didn't receive it 1 year, they could apply next year. We just know that there's a lot of people that need the qualifications. Even with all those additional pieces that we look to, we're still getting many, many people who would qualify, and we just don't have the funds to serve.
Thank you.
And Ms. McCauley, can you just, you talked about having information on the funding, et cetera. There's this page, this Child Care Aware, and on the bottom it says retained funding. Is the, are these must, this must be the federal funding then? So it was $446,000 in 2015, 2016, $415,000 in 2016, 2017, et cetera. So this, and then $224,000 in 2017, 2018. This would essentially then, essentially double that of $250,000 in state money to match a roughly similar amount in federal. Am I reading that right?
Correct, Mr. Chair. That is just a graph over time of what we've been able to. And whenever we have additional funding, we try to put it into retain. It's fluctuated as other. This is based on the child care and development block grant funds we receive. And so during years when there was funding from Race to the Top, and that was helping with some of the other funds, we could put more block grant money into retain. But unfortunately, we're back down now to that about 200, 225 level.
That's helpful. Thank you. Representative Damuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Wasilewicz, on the bill, under the administration piece, it says that up to 10% of the grant might be used for administration costs. Is there a reason why 10% was chosen rather than the typical 3 to 5%?
Representative Wasilewicz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Damon. I can't speak to that, and I didn't pick that number, so I think I'll see if Ms. McCauley right now.
Mr. Chair, Representative Damuth, I believe that is to mirror the amount that is allowed by the federal CCDF plan right now.
Thank you.
Do we have a sense as to how much has been typical? You said if it's mirroring the amount in the past, so what that figure has been? Has it been close to 10%? Is it just, do you have a sense of that, Ms. McCauley?
Mr. Chair, members, it's a little hard to articulate because it's blended with other funds. The other program we run is the Teach Early Learning Scholarship Program, and we also run CDA scholarship programs, and those are all together under the heading of financial supports. So across all of those, it might be approaching 10, but it's varied. Depending on the time and intensity of the staffing.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any other member questions? Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Damon. I'm sorry. No, please, yeah.
Perfect. Thanks,
apologies,
Mr. Chair. With that answer, thank you very much. Is it possible that we could get that information? Because I wouldn't want to see 10%, up to 10% on this particular one, and then added with others. Is it possible that we could get a little more detail?
Ms. McCauley?
Mr. Chair, Representative Damon, I'm sure we can talk with the department about what the appropriate number, if that isn't the appropriate number, what the appropriate number should be.
Thank you.
All right.
Thanks.
Thank you. Anything else? So nothing else from members, and so Representative Wasilewicz will give you the final word on your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just again expressing, I think some of us who have worked in child care know that retaining staff is a really big concern, so wanting to make sure that if we can do this as a state to invest in these child care providers, I think is really important, to ensure that we have folks to be around to care for our kids. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks to you for bringing this forward and to your testifiers, too. And so with that, I will lay House File 2260-64 over for possible inclusion in a division report. And so many thanks to you. Just a pause. Our next bill is House File 2111. And I wonder, is there somebody here who's here to testify on its behalf? Who will be here? Okay, our author is wanting to connect. We want to connect her up with testifier. So, in that case, I guess we will. We'll get going. So, House File 2111 is the next bill up, and that's authored by Representative Katiza Watoon. And so, as she makes her way up, We will, she is moving that House File 2111 be laid over for possible inclusion in on, in a division report. Is that correct, Representative Cadiz? Yes, I think that 2111
be laid over potentially.
Thank you. And then, Representative Cadiz Witun, you have an amendment coded A1. Is that correct? Okay. And do you wish to offer that as an author's amendment?
Yes. I move to amend HF 2111.
Okay. Any discussion or questions regarding that, members? And hearing none, all in favor of adoption of the author's amendment, the A1, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. And any opposed? Okay, the bill is in the shape that you would like it to be, so Representative Patiza Witun, please describe your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill, 2111, is an appropriation for the Reach Out and Read program across the state of Minnesota. And essentially, what this program does is partner with health professionals across the state of Minnesota in order to provide books to children at their annual wellness checks. And this is something that my children have been able to take part of. It was a wonderful surprise when I went to my first appointment as a foster mom and that my kids got to take home a book, and they were thrilled with it, so expanding our home library. But we know that upwards of 90% of families actually follow through on their annual wellness exams, and so it's reaching families where they are and to encourage literacy and growth in that way for their children. So I'd be glad to introduce my testifier now to speak a little more.
Yeah, please, please do so. Yeah, thanks. And please identify yourself for the record, and then please proceed with your testimony.
Excellent. Thank you. Good evening, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dr. J.P. Chawla, and I'm a pediatrician and the chief of general pediatrics at Children's Minnesota. I live and practice in the Twin Cities, and I'm here today as a board member of and on behalf of the Minnesota chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics to support House File 2111. Gaps in oral vocabulary have been shown to become apparent as early as 18 to 24 months of age. There's evidence that children from low socioeconomic households have decreased oral vocabularies compared to their peers at age 2, and that oral vocabulary at age 2 is a predictor of kindergarten academic performance and behavioral function. Children who aren't exposed to reading in that first 1,000 days of life have an increased risk of being part of the 30 million word gap noted upon kindergarten entry, which may lead to achievement gaps in school years and contribute to adults who are illiterate or with reduced employment opportunities, who then subsequently end up at risk for worse health. Reach Out and Read Minnesota trains physicians and nurse practitioners to equip parents to be their child's first teacher and pairs that with developmentally appropriate books at their doctor's visits between the ages of 6 months and 5 years. This model has existed for over 30 years and is backed by over a dozen peer-reviewed studies that show us that families served by clinics participating in Reach Out and Read are more likely to read to their children, that attendance at well child checks is increased, prompting health improvements, and that children score higher on expressive and receptive language scores. As the representative mentioned, roughly 90% of children will seek a medical provider at least once in their first year of life, while for comparison, only about 40% of children under age 2 are in a licensed daycare center. A pediatrician or family medicine doctor is not only a relative constant present in the first 3 years of a child's young life, but a trusted messenger that parents and caregivers can depend on. That is why interventions that use healthcare infrastructure and meet families where they're at, like Reach Out and Read Minnesota, are the low-hanging fruit that we are currently not reaping in our efforts to address opportunity gaps in early childhood and to set communities up for downstream successes. In my practice, I see many patients of different socioeconomic classes, race and ethnic groups, and health and disabilities. The one universal truth is how offering a book is an entry point for many discussions. Specifically, I see toddlers put down cell phones to reach for that book. Having a book to frame that discussion about brain development and language provides a powerful example that helps even more when trying to convince parents about the harms of excessive media use. Having a book right there and modeling its use in the room gives parents options and skills that in the moment they know they can use when they leave the clinic visit in their own homes. When a parent reads to their child, a bond is strengthened. When a child loves reading, they acquire the tools to write their own story. Your support of House File 2111 will help ensure that children and families across our great state will have access to these tools. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Doctor. Thanks for your testimony. Representative Cadiz Witun, are you aware of any other testifiers on your behalf? Or Dr. Chawla, if you're aware. I will note, members, there's a letter from the Minnesota Medical Association that actually is in the packet for 2264 because it's labeled 2264, but it actually appears that they had a typo when they gave us the letter. It's actually in support of this bill along with a number of other medical associations. So thank you.
Thank you for pointing that out, Mr. Chair. Yes, there are a few additional statements of support. You haven't had a chance to review those yet.
Thank you. Yeah. So then any member of the public who wants to testify for or against the bill? I'm not seeing anyone, so we'll move to member questions. If any, Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it was this summer we had a great presentation to our Rotary Club about Reach Out and Read program that was really in-depth and very impressive about it. It seemed like there was also opportunities for partnerships with community organizations to kind of extend the amount of books that could be available, create libraries and things like that. Can you speak to that at all, just to prod my memory about what those opportunities were?
And Dr. Chawla.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. You know, I certainly think that any of this funding could be used to develop and strengthen some of those partnerships. Mm-hmm. I don't know specifically about the partnership that you're discussing or alluding to, but I think that's the purpose of this, is to be able to set that up for success. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions from members at all? Oh, Representative Wozniak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering if you can talk a little bit about, I don't know a lot about this program, I know what it is, and I really support the program, but about how it's funded generally. Like, is this the only way that it's funded, or what other funding money might go into that program?
Dr. Chawla, for yep. Dr. Chawla.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. As the Chief of General Pediatrics, I can tell you what a significant challenge it is to secure that funding and to secure it long term. At times, we're able to put it right into operational dollars. Each book costs about $2 or so. We seek grants, those are not always as reliable as they can be. I think for the most part across the metro area, it is a mix of both grants and donations and operational dollars.
Yes, Representative Wozniak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would imagine with this grant money, would some of those partnerships continue then with the medical places and some of the community organizations?
Dr. Chawla.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, for the clarification and Representative. Yes, I think that's exactly it, that securing these fundings helps promote and secure those relationships for the long term.
I know, Representative Wozniak, that there's, my understanding, Dr. Chawla, is there's quite a lot of individual fundraising that goes on, events throughout the year, and I mean, you and your fellow physicians are really hustling a lot to try to get as much support for this as possible in all kinds of ways, including through this. So, is that correct?
Yes, thank you, yeah. Mr. Chair. That's exactly right. We do feel like we're doing a lot of work. So this would really help that cause.
Yeah, I remember hearing about, I think there was some kind of, you know, a beer dabbler or some kind of, there's just a wide variety of events going on all the time to try to provide support for this. So good. Yeah, thank you. Any other questions from members or comments? So then, seeing none, so then I will allow Representative Katizer to impart me to get the final word on her bill then. Please.
Mr. Chair, this bill has great bipartisan and bicameral support. Senator Howley is carrying it in the Senate this year, and so I'm hopeful that we are going to be able to about as much
money
as we are able.
So. Okay. Thank you. And actually, you know, I'm sorry, I did think of one thing. This is a blank appropriation. Dr. Chawla, am I right in thinking that this is pretty scalable? Sort of, you know, you'll make use of whatever dollars there are, then it's $2 per book. The more there are, the more kids can be reached, et cetera, et cetera. But is there some sort of anything we should be thinking about as we're assessing that point?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's a difficult message to address, but certainly as a healthcare provider for Children's Minnesota, we see about 275,000 kids each year, and in that, we strive to be able to offer at Well Child Checks a book to every child between the ages of 6 months and 5 years. For us, it is a significant dollar figure in order to do that, and I think every organization does that same exact thing, which is they will prioritize those books to the younger children as they're able. So, yes, any dollar figure would be used to really scale that up and down.
Okay, good. Thank you so much. Yeah, thank you. Thank you again, Representative Katizer Batoon. And with that, I will lay over House File 2111 for possible inclusion in an omnibus. Possible inclusion as amended in division report. Thank you so much, Representative Katizer Batoon, and your testifier, Dr. Chawla. So with that, Representative Brand, you're up for two bills. These are our final two on the agenda. It is perfect timing. Preference, Representative Brand, for which bill we address first?
Let's do it in sequence.
Okay, so House File 422. Let's do that, okay. House File 422, this bill, the plan is for us to refer it to Health and Services Finance in a little finance way. And I have a motion to refer House File 422 to HHS Finance.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Cortez Witum. So we have that motion. I don't believe there is an amendment on, well, not on this one anyway. There will be on the other one. And so, Representative Rand, to your bill, sir.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for allowing me to be here today to talk about 422 and 423. We'll talk about 422 first, which is a $3 million appropriation in the year fiscal year 2020 for the purposes of training and engaging the private sector and investing local resources to support community action and child care. As a former city council member in St. Peter, myself and another elected official, another city council member, were joking one day about how difficult it was to find child care in St. Peter. That was back in 2013. We both had infants. It was difficult. And it just so happened that the city administrator at that time had been listening and said, oh, well, really? Tell me more. And from that conversation, that side conversation that we had before the council meeting, that turned into a daycare study within the city of St. Peter.
And hello, Representative Brand, slide the microphone towards you. Just basically, just want to make absolutely sure you're being captured by it.
So, people
hear. So it's recorded, et cetera. So please continue.
Yeah, absolutely. So, from that discussion, there was a study that was undertaken. We contacted the county, the school system. We talked to a whole bunch of different stakeholders. We talked to providers. We talked to industry leaders at Taylor Corporation and other places. And we figured out there was a child care shortage in our area. And so based off of that study and the results, we were able to put together $2 million. That could be used for daycare providers. Now, not all of that $2 million obviously was spent, but that was used from EDA money dedicated towards, building a better, more robust childcare situation in St. Peter. So we were able to get a center to move into St. Peter using some of those EDA dollars. We were able to also provide in-home daycare providers the opportunity to start out, basically. So startup costs were found out to be one of the barriers for new providers in St. Peter. And so we offered some assistance to folks if they were to remain in business for an amount of time for their startup costs, so the training, for the facilities, upgrades necessary because of regulations and that sort of thing to get their homes ready for child care. And so from that, we were able to get some providers in town. And so from that, we've got two proposals tonight that are basically tailors of from the micro level, it's what we did in St. Peter, but from the macro level in Minnesota. We know there's a crisis, and it's not just in Minnesota. It wasn't just in St. Peter. It's a national crisis for providers. In 19A, where I represent, there's 16 centers and 45 providers, and it's just not enough. If you look at Mankato, for instance, there's a shortage of about 863 slots. In fact, Jack Conser and I share the district together, District 19, and he and I had a couple of meetings with some in-home providers on one night and then centers on another night. And the in-home providers in particular were telling us that at some point during the conversation with the current customers that they have, there would be a conversation about how they would want to start their family, progress their family, more children, that sort of thing. But in order for that to happen, they had to find out if there was a slot within that provider, within that system there. So that's kind of a weird way to start a family, with having a conversation with your provider before the other spouse. And so from my standpoint, this is not a healthy situation in Mankato. It's not a healthy situation in Minnesota. And so tonight, with House File 422, we're going to ask for a $3 million appropriation to tackle one of the issues that we did in St. Peter, and then 423 will be I'll speak on in a minute.
Okay. Well, thank you. So you have testifiers, Representative Brand.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Why don't we bring up the first one?
So the first one, Scott.
Please identify yourself for the record, Mr. Van, and have the microphone right in front of you when the time comes, and then please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify on behalf of House File 422. My name is Scott McMahon, and I'm here tonight on behalf of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities and the Greater Minnesota Partnership. We represent cities, economic development agencies, businesses, and chambers of commerce across Greater Minnesota. I do not need to tell this committee that Minnesota faces a child care crisis. There are aspects of this crisis that impact the metro and greater Minnesota the same. But as you heard from testifiers at the St. Cloud hearing, the crisis is manifesting itself in a very unique and challenging way in our communities, and that is its impact on our local economies. In the past 2 years, child care has rocketed up to the number one issue negatively impacting economic development in Greater Minnesota. According to the Center of Rural Policy Development, between 2006 and 2015, we lost 15,000 child care slots in Greater Minnesota, and now have a shortage of more than 35,000. Because of the child care deficit, we now have businesses deciding whether to locate or expand in our communities based on whether child care is available in a community. We have employees turning down job offers when they discover there's no child care available in the community they're working and moving into. We have families and employees leaving our communities because there's no child care. This is no longer a child care crisis in Greater Minnesota. It is a full-blown economic crisis. I've shared with you a listing of articles published in Greater Minnesota over the past 2 years, 58 in total. Mr. Chairman, I have copies available for you today. 158 pages of testimony from our communities about how this crisis is hurting our communities and our ability to prosper. You also have a fact sheet that provides supporting data on how deep the child care crisis is in Greater Minnesota. House File 422 looks to provide $3 million in funding to the six Minnesota Initiative Foundations to provide the training, business development, and community engagement we need to stabilize and begin to grow our child care industry. The work proposed in this bill is not new work. It is work the Initiative Foundations have been doing for years, and the work that the deed grants the past couple years have supported. These past efforts, in many ways, are pilot projects in our communities, have proven to us what works. We know how we can stabilize our existing provider base and start to expand the sector. The funds requested under this bill will allow us to take these pilot projects and begin to bring them to scale across our six regions. You will hear more from testifiers about why, in Greater Minnesota, the Initiative Foundations are uniquely positioned to best guarantee that the full needs of Greater Minnesota are met. But please know, the foundations partner with countless other groups, such as First Children's Finance, Families First, and Child Care Aware Minnesota, to make sure providers get the technical assistance, training, and support they need to succeed. There are many things this committee will propose to address the broad child care crisis that is hurting our state. But in Greater Minnesota, in addition to those efforts around, we need the ideas outlined in House File 422 to address our specific challenges. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. McMahon. Representative Brand, anybody else do you have? Looks like... Okay. Hello, please, you'll need to speak right in the mic, and please identify yourself for the record, and then please proceed.
Sure. Good evening. My name is Nicole Brunswick-Nicholson. I'm Executive Director of Region 9 Development Commission in Mankato, Minnesota. We are an economic development district that covers the nine counties around Mankato. And I also have the pleasure of serving as the Greater Minnesota Partnership's president for the past 2 years, which sister organizations, the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, as Scott just mentioned. The past 7 years, I've served as Executive Director of Region 9, and as I stated, we do economic development. But in the past 3 years, all of a sudden, our number one legislative issue priority has been child care. And so that has really dominated our conversations and really made us kind of pivot as to what can we do and what can we get behind to help support to work on this important issue. I'm here in support of this bill, as I greatly appreciate the MIF's involvement, the Minnesota Initiative Foundations. For those of you who are not familiar, they do fabulous work. Of my nine counties, it is covered by Southern Minnesota Initiative Foundation, SMITH. They also serve another 11 counties of Southeast Minnesota. We really truly work hand in glove as we really support each other's work. And so I'm supportive of this legislation because, again, the MIFs are really trusted advisors. They know their communities. They're very in tune and very well connected to the regional issues. And so, again, because they serve all of the 80 counties of Greater Minnesota, it only makes sense that they are a partner as we continue to address this child care shortage. I'd like to read some information from Southern Minnesota Initiative Foundation about some specifics of what they've been able to achieve from the good work that has started with the DEED grants and the specific MIF grants. In Smith region, we have 20 counties with a population of 730,000. We currently have approximately 1,600 family providers and 140 centers. There is a shortage of over 8,600 slots. With our small deed grants last year that we partnered with First Children's Finance on $37,500, which is the Smith amount, we helped create 411 new child care slots, along with doing numerous trainings and offering other resources such as a curriculum. In our current quality care program, 83% of our program participants increased their knowledge and skills that support child development, 96% of participants increased the quality of their business skills, and an average of 97% of attendees rated the trainings as high value. And so again, I'd like to, realizing that there is no silver bullet for the child care shortage issue, I appreciate that this committee is looking at all different types of bills that address brick and mortar issues that centers and in-home providers address, as well as the training needs.
like parent aware and different things like that. Again, the initiative foundations work closely with their communities. This allows them to be able to go out and offer trainings to the communities, which really helps the providers be able to not have to travel and have the extra undue cost and other burdens. As well as, so we know that the child care crisis is one of our biggest legislative priorities, but again, in southern Minnesota, we, like a lot of the rest of Minnesota, is already experiencing a workforce shortage that is becoming a crisis, so we truly need every single worker who would like to work to be able to be at work and not have to kind of juggle whether or not they're going to have to choose to stay home or find other options. For instance, in my office, we have about 10 employees, just last April, one of our employees, their family grew by one, and I said, you know, do you have child care set up? And they're new to the area, and they're not well connected. And no, but well, you know, we're going to look into it. And I said, you're in so much trouble, and I had just hired this employee, so I'm thinking I'm in trouble. And so I want to kind of quote a little write-up that he did for me. He said, here's the basics. The waiting list for infants ranged from 9 months to 18 months. We just heard back from one of the local providers, and they have an opening for Ava in November 2019 in the infant room when she's technically no longer an infant, but a toddler. In other words, the wait is so long that when a spot opens up for infants, the child is no longer in that category. We called every location we could think of weekly, and a spot just happened to be open after 9 months. If we hadn't called that day to that particular provider, we would have missed that opportunity. I spent more time calling child care centers than I've ever spent looking for a job. Several kids in Ava's child care home come from over an hour away. The economic waste of having parents and children travel in excess of 2 hours per day to find daycare is apparent. Luckily for him, he has a wonderful, flexible boss who needed him to be at work, and so little Ava sat through many conference calls and was in our office much more than I would have ever had guessed. However, we needed his time and talent, and so we were trying to be as flexible and accommodating, and the question of how is that coming along, he got that question every now and then, and I tried to be as polite yet persistent as possible with that encouragement. So again, I appreciate the legislation that's been brought by my representative, and I appreciate the committee working on this very important issue and looking at multifaceted, so thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. And Ms. Jost, if you can introduce yourself, identify yourself for the record, and then please proceed with your testimony.
Good evening, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Nancy Jost. I'm the Director of Early Childhood at West Central Initiative, which is based out of Fergus Falls, and we are one of the six Minnesota Initiative Foundations. I am here to express my support for House File 422. There is a child care shortage that we all know about in all of Minnesota, but what is unique in rural Minnesota is that some people are not moving to our communities, and even if they're from our community, they're not taking jobs they want and need because they cannot find child care. Businesses are thinking twice about locating in rural Minnesota because of the child care shortage. Access in rural Minnesota is an even greater issue than affordability. We're all part of one Minnesota, and when rural families, businesses, and communities struggle with this issue, it affects all of Minnesota. Some of you may be asking why the funding should go to the MIFs, the Minnesota Initiative Foundations. First of all, we cover all of rural Minnesota, and I think that's unique to the MIFs. I might be wrong about that, but I think so. Secondly, businesses, family child care providers, child care centers, and communities are used to partnering with us to make our communities economically viable and the best place they can be for children to grow and thrive. Child care is part of the economic development of communities by allowing parents to go to work, but it's also a business in and of itself. High-quality child care also helps children prepare for school and life. Thirdly, the MIFs work closely with Child Care Aware, licensors, and First Children's Finance, and many others, to recruit and retain child care providers. We partner in trainings, technical assistance, and supporting child care providers however we can. An example of this is we are just going to be having our second annual meeting of those who work with child care providers in our region, and we're meeting to better work together to support providers, find out what each of us is doing, and see how we can better support providers. We also work closely with DHS, MDE, MDH, and DEED on projects and committees, so we're used to working with lots of different people. The MIFs are well equipped to put this funding to good use to decrease the child care shortage. We have a history of doing this, and we have the ability to do it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. And Elisha Dobbs Jost is the chair of the Early Learning Council as well for the state, so just make sure that that's noted. And please, Ms. Stout, identify yourself for the record, and please proceed.
I'm Stacey Stout, the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today in support of increasing the supply of quality child care in our state. The Minnesota Chamber represents over 2,300 companies, mostly small to medium-sized businesses, and the number one concern we hear is the skilled workforce shortage. And as everyone in this committee knows, the current need for workers is hindered by our child care shortage in our communities. As the previous testifiers shared, the acute shortage of affordable child care facilities, particularly in greater Minnesota, impacts employment opportunities for those with young children and compounds the workforce shortage for employers. This legislation addresses the shortage by facilitating community planning to increase the supply of quality child care and participation in Parent Aware, Minnesota's quality and improvement rating system. This is key for two reasons, one, in addressing our current workforce shortage, and two, in addressing our future workforce shortage. In addressing our current workforce shortage, it allows parents to go to work and feel good knowing their children are in a quality learning environment. And two, in addressing our future workforce shortage, it ensures that children from all backgrounds will have access to high-quality learning environments, preparing them for kindergarten, and ultimately closing the achievement gap. Therefore, we support this legislation because it will help communities to increase their number of high-quality child care providers. To keep our workforce challenges from hampering economic growth, we must support and encourage the growth of high-quality early child care providers. We appreciate this committee's work and appreciate Representative Brand bringing this forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Stout. And I should highlight the crisis work group report put together by the Chamber of Commerce and many other groups focusing on the child care crisis and also the opportunity gap crisis. And I know these bills, I think, are coming out of part of that work, and along with a number of other recommendations. So thank you to you and the Chamber and others for your work. Thank you. Yeah. I think we're moving to now to public. Come on up, and then we'll have additional testifiers as well from public. And so please identify yourself, and then please proceed.
I'm Cindy Cunningham. I'm the Public Policy Chair for MCPIN, the Minnesota Child Family Chapter. I don't like acronyms. Sorry, that's even ours. Anyway, we're the 501c3 that's statewide. I really appreciate all of the listeners just at the Senate hearing and the constant communication about child care and the crisis and the need for parents for access to child care and the expansion of these monies and such. The one caution I have in this one, and I'll speak to the 423, is when we talk about encouraging for parent aware participation. I know many of you have heard this in other ways. I actually help support providers through some communication systems with Facebook and otherwise. I've, for many years, trying to help encourage family child care providers to participate. I think for the initiatives or anyone to continue to encourage family child care, which is the affordable child care and the connected consistency of care for families, there needs to be a really good look about why providers are not participating in Parent Aware. There's some strict barriers, there's some motivation. We are businesses, so if there's not a cost return, anyone who has a business, if there's not an investment return on it, it's a very difficult step in. And some of the processes, and I've experienced it myself, where I was denied a rating because my coach messed up and the reviewer didn't agree, and I couldn't get the appeal in, so I lost a star rating. So those kinds of things I would hope would be critically be looked on why family child care is not participating and what it would take to encourage.
Thank you so much, Ms. Cunningham.
Thanks.
Other testifiers for against the bill, please, come on down. Yeah. And so when you get there, you can make sure the mic's right in front of you and just identify yourself for the record, and then please begin.
Apologies for being
daycare
fresh, but...
That's the important... You're doing the important work.
I'm actually in opposition to this bill, and I encourage you all to vote against it as well. No offense to you.
Make sure to identify yourself, if you can, please.
I am Molly Ricky Hochschult.
And can you spell your name, just as we didn't have it before?
Hang on. R-I-E-K-E hyphen H-O-F as in Frank, S-C-H-U-L-T-E.
Thank you, and then please proceed.
I'm in opposition to the Parent Aware portion of this bill as well. A 20-year licensed family child care provider. My testimony was in May. I had a child die of SIDS in my care with a sudden infant death syndrome, and how his memory and my service was dishonored by DHS. I am a former Governor Dayton-appointed Minnesota Early Learning Council member, so thank you for your service, because I know what that's all about. I'm glad to be done. 10 years ago, I was warning of Parent Aware's lack of quality controls, outcomes, consistency, and negative impacts on small child care providers. The legislative auditor confirmed my warning of serious failings in accountability for early learning systems in their early learning systems report about 6 months ago. Parent Aware still has low participation rates. Like the majority of providers, I do not want my reputation-based business associated with a fraud-filled program that does not ensure quality. This failing system, brought on by the legislative fundings like this, and initiative foundations, I'm sorry, I'm nervous all of a sudden.
No problem. Take a breath and take your time.
Oh, yeah. Brought on by legislative actions like this, and pushed by initiative foundations, nonprofits, unions, pushing CCAF and Parent Aware, has created a child care shortage and rate hike amongst my business class. The numbers speak: 30% loss of family child care and a 300% increase in Head Starts, public, and large chains in the last 5 years. You need to vet someone that has something to gain or lose by who sits in the seat speaks to you. And who they're tied to when they're playing with our lives. You're exchanging a great child care option for options 2 to 4 times the cost of taxpayers on taxpayers' backs. Allowing the redefining of government assistance as scholarship and increasing what people can make to 400% of the federal poverty guidelines creates competitive inequality as private pay, small business. I can't compete with government steering clients providing Parent Aware offering tax-paid free child care. Small cares are consistently multi-checked by county and held accountable to not just our counties but to the state and taxpayers. We are disadvantaged compared to those left uninspected and untouched, some for 30 years, since 1989. That's false advertising to parents not aware they are placing children in high-quality centers that have maltreatments and neglect. Small cares are being held to unequal and unprotected standards. DHS, which is under the OIG, they're both the same umbrella, as you know, lack consistency in rules and is disconnected from the provider world. Example, in my case, DHS refused to follow a judge's order and rewrote my innocence to guilt in our sudden infant death case, including rewriting the head detective, the coroner's report, and the judge. While in another sudden infant death case, again, was willing to destroy a provider's life until I told her to record these people and she busted them on recording. DHS and the OIG immediately reopened her before a judge could even deem if she was safe. Including that provider receiving a check, which you are all aware of, I dropped off packets last week that was included as well. Lack of consistency and truthfulness in DHS and the OIG puts everyone's children at risk. Small business child care is being legislatively targeted for removal. At this point, after 201 packets were dropped off, the deadline tomorrow, it's no longer able to be said, you don't know we're unprotected. The health and safety of children in over 100 programs was reported by 14 DHS inspectors that were prior law enforcement yesterday in the report. They are mandated reporters. That was found by the OLA. We need to protect kids in Minnesota and provide before we worry about profits on kids in Minnesota and providers before we worry about, on past legislation that stands to gain and stock traded child cares. You guys need to clean up DHS and the OIG. You need to clean up their act. Frankly, you guys need to clean up yours and learn what we're about. I am one of a few thousand remaining. We were at 11,000 when I started Early Learning Council. When I spoke in Lake City in September, we were at 8. We're under 8 now, aren't we, Cindy, for home? I believe the last time was around 7,800. I put myself and all I had on the line to save Bryson and failed by our system, our state, everyone. Now the question is, will you continue to stop protecting children and others in this state and increase the rate of falling off of home child care? Or will you stand up and protect us and stop legislation like this? Stop legislation that funds Parent Aware and not holding all of us accountable. These programs are deceitful, so they are profit-driven legislation. You have to ask who's got stuff to gain. Thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing your experience, your perspective with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Is anyone else in the audience who wishes to share? Please, yeah. So when you get there, please say you can just identify yourself for the record. Make sure you're speaking right into the microphone so you're recorded, and then please proceed. And you need to identify yourself first.
Sure. My name is Brittany Browning, and I'm a former child care center director in Mankato and preschool teacher. I was doing that job for the last 10 years.
Okay.
Exactly 1 year ago today, I testified for the first time on Representative Franson's committee. I'm here to discuss the idea of House File 422 mm-hmm. in regards to giving you a point of view of the trainer. In 2010, Child Care Aware / Child Care Resource and Referral, Families First, whatever you want to call them, pursued me to be a trainer because they had heard from various of their participants of how great of a person I was, how energetic I was. So they begged me to be a trainer, and I agreed. In 2010, I began that adventure. Before I knew it, I was training Monday through Thursday, going all the way to Laverne, all the way to Winona, all the way up to the cities. Every single weeknight, every single Saturday, I enjoyed it. Until DHS ruined it all. DHS decided to, I guess, target me is the best way I can say it. In 2013, they gave my child care center 25 citations. I had no idea this was coming. Fixed those citations, was on a roll, training was booming, I was getting rave reviews from my supervisors at Child Care Aware, at Child Care Resource and Referral, saying, Brittany, we're hearing great things. You are doing awesome. Can we book you more? I am certified to teach over 60 trainings to these providers. It all came to a crashing halt officially in 2016 when I got a letter of resignation from them saying everything is done because I violated a term of their contract that said, you guarantee to not have any negative actions. How am I to guarantee that licensing isn't going to light me up for something like a plunger, leaves in my entryway? It's a business. I cannot stop the weather from blowing wind and leaves into my entryway. Are you for real? You will not get any more providers like me because DHS is ruining it. You have to start looking at DHS, cleaning it from the top all the way down to the bottom. I was a target. I was going into my center at 2:30 in the morning. Does that sound like a great time to you? Because it wasn't. I was threatened. I lost $75,000 a year because DHS is able to pick and choose who they want to make their life hell for. They get to say, you know what, I'm going to interpret this rule this way. That's what I'm going to do. I have no chance. I never had one exit interview. Then, in March of last year, I fought, and with the help of Elizabeth Bangert, I was gifted a new licensor because I was able to prove that my licensor was harassing me and out of line. But to make things really great, they didn't want to just give me one licensor, they gave me two. Does that sound fair to you? How are you going to get quality trainers when your quality trainers are getting attacked? I can give you a list of over 50 people statewide that will tell you they miss me. I'm the one person that they wish they could have a training with again. But my licensor destroyed it. I got an attorney. I fought it. Spent over $30,000 and I lost. And now my center that I was running is officially closed because the owners could no longer afford to stay open because we were fighting DHS. I don't get to train people anymore unless they privately hire me. So about the high quality trainers, we're out there, but they're crushing us. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for sharing. Anyone else who wishes to testify, please, yeah, come on down. Yeah. Please identify yourself for the record, Ms. Bangert, please, and then please proceed.
I'm Elizabeth Bangert, and I'll be really quick.
Where are you from?
Yesterday, the Office of Inspector General released something regarding fraud, but in there, what a lot of people didn't realize was about quality. And the word quality is all over this bill. And we talk about parent-aware all of the time, and I'm not going to get off the parent-aware bandwagon even as a four-star parent-aware rated center,
we have a problem. The problem is that you have 14 individuals who are investigators that say they had concerns of a large number of centers and no one was looking at them. Inside the Office of Inspector General and the licensing, underneath Carolyn Hamm and Regina Landner, you have all of the maltreatment out there. If we're going to continue to take away people's four-star parent-aware ratings if they have maltreatment, then you had better do it for everyone, and that includes the chain centers. If you aren't going to do that, and you are not going to hold everyone to the same standard of law, then one must ask themselves what is truly going on in the Department of Human Services and the OIG. You need to fire Carolyn Hamm. And if you will not fire her, I have a number of individuals who have contacted me and will be more than willing to sue the state of Minnesota. So I highly suggest that you immediately make that a priority, because I have a lot of evidence that that agency was trying to silence me. Pretty disgusting evidence. And I'm tired of being targeted and followed around this Capitol. This is not going to solve the crisis. The child care crisis exists because DHS created a child care crisis and now is going to put it on taxpayers to foot the bill while destroying people like Molly's life. I get phone calls all the time. By noon, my voicemail is full every day. Someone needs to stop the Department of Human Services and clean it up. Clean up the Department of Human Services. There's plenty of evidence, and someone should make sure that the counties respond to the FOIA requests for all of the data that they have done to all of these different providers. But at a minimum, if you have 14 law enforcement officers who are telling you they had serious concerns with what was going on in centers, and you're wondering how there was not communication, what are they hiding? And no one better go playing Enron, because this is not just happening in Minnesota. It's happening in Louisiana. It's happening in Colorado. It's happening in Washington. Because newsflash, these centers are publicly traded, some of them on the global market. So ask yourself where your tax dollars are going and who owns stock. Because we're tired of being discriminated against. The Parents Aware program is a sham. And if it wasn't a sham, then the report from 2016, that child care trends issue that's 140 pages long, would not have a phrase that says, aside from the paperwork portion of Parents Aware, when the independent people came into centers, there was no difference in instruction or quality of interactions with staff between a one-star rated facility in a family or center or a four-star. It's all about the paperwork. And then if you go further down in that report, there's seven different categories, and they've only looked for evidence in one category. Give me a break. This whole thing is a sham. So knock it off, clean out DHS, and quite frankly, red or blue, we're tired of getting screwed. So just do your job and clean it up.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Banger, for sharing your testimony. It looks like somebody else is coming up to testify. Mr. Bartholomew, please identify yourself for the record, and then please share your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership, and wasn't planning to testify, but I just, and I'm not here to defend the Department of Human Services or regulatory enforcement, but I did just want to maybe set the record straight on a couple items, one dealing with Parent Aware. This is from the department, and it shows the number of various provider types that are participating in Parent Aware. And from 2013 to 2018, the number of family child care providers that are Parent Aware rated grew from 233 in 2013 to now over 1,100. By far and away, the most most represented type of child care provider in the state. And I would just like to add that the Parent Aware rating system has been independently evaluated twice, in 2011 and again in 2016. And each time, the independent evaluations have found that children of Parent Aware rated providers have actually done well as a result of that. And in fact, the gains for low-income children are greater than their other peers. So Parent Aware does work, and actually there are more family child care providers in Parent Aware than any other kind of child care provider.
I gather you're speaking in favor of the bill then, Mr. Bartholomew?
I mostly wanted to just straighten the record that there was a lot of things said about Parent Aware. some of which weren't totally accurate.
Okay, this is our perspective on parent aware. Okay, thank you, sir. Please come on up. Please identify yourself for the record, and then please, you want to speak right into the microphone, and then please proceed.
Thank you, Chair and representatives. My name is Cisa Kaller. I'm the Senior Vice President of Early Childhood Quality Development at Think Small. Also had not planned on testifying, but wanted to thank Senator Brand and our colleagues.
Don't do that to him, please.
And our partners that have brought this bill forward. It's a very important bill, and we are very supportive of the bill. But I wanted to address or provide some information that I think is relevant to this piece. Obviously, this bill is very much about economic viability of greater Minnesota, with a particular focus on the child care and how it supports community, as well as child care itself as an economic driver. And Think Small was, through a private grant, actually looked at closure issues around child care closure, particularly around licensed family child care. And so we actually did a survey. We surveyed all the licensed family child care providers that closed the doors between January of 2015 and January of 2017. And, you know, just asked the various reasons why they had closed their doors, what were contributing factors, what things we could have done to support them in staying in business if they had wanted to stay in business. And I can certainly forward this particular survey to you. But the part that I wanted to highlight here was we did an analysis as it relates to parent aware, and I'm actually just going to read it because otherwise I say it wrong. But additional analysis was completed regarding parent aware participation and the rate of closure of family child care providers from January 2015 to January of 2017. The results show that non-parent aware participating providers had a closure rate of almost three times the closure rate of parent aware participating providers. And so we just think that's really significant. We don't know what the correlation is, but there seems to be evidence that there was a correlation between parent aware participation and a successful business that is staying in business. So I just wanted to highlight that as well.
Thank you, Ms. Keller, for your perspective. Anyone else who wishes to testify for or against the bill? Okay, so seeing none, we're going to move on to member questions, if there are any. Special members at all. Yeah, Representative Francis.
All right, so back to my spiel about we can throw money at it, it's not going to solve the problem. So on Wednesday, I was out to dinner. What's today, Thursday? Tuesday, I was out to dinner, and a provider from my district contacted me in the evening. And she was given a temporary immediate suspension, and she did not know why. So I started doing some, asking her to send me some stuff, and she got a letter served to her on Friday from the licensor saying that, that on February 26th, that Douglas County received a report regarding the conditions of the daycare home. Sounds pretty serious, right? The report alleged hazardous conditions at your child care program. Douglas County observed through the investigation numerous health and safety violations inside and outside your home. Additionally, behavior guidance violations were observed at each visit. So, long story short, issued a temporary immediate suspension. So I'm like, well, what was found? She said she was not sure who turned her in, if it was like parents, but she was scratching her head saying, I don't understand what happened. She also said that the licensor came out three separate times, March 1st, 4th, and 7th. They have an attached garage, wasn't exactly sure, like was it the propane tank? The licensor didn't say anything to her. She told, she got no details. And was just told she was going to be shut down until further notice. Yada, yada. When she was there, she said, like the provider said that there's some mini empty propane tanks in the garage, a gas can, and her husband's tools, like most garages have. These are home licensed providers, right? She said, it's like we can't live where we provide care. Everything has to be perfect nowadays. I just figured she was back to try and find something since she hadn't found anything the first time, and she didn't say much when she came out either. Just a couple of questions and we'll be in touch. I asked her, did you find anything, any issues? And she said, we'll be in contact, like it was some sort of huge secret. Okay, so I got some more information, who's the licensor. So I sent an email yesterday to the licensor, yesterday, Tuesday night in the evening, because I just couldn't sleep. So I came back to the office, composed this email. So also my constituent had some sort of peace of mind that this was being worked on. This is her income, her livelihood. plus the parents in this child care crisis are left wondering, where am I going to send my kids? So she got an email on some of the issues from the licensor. I have not received an email back from the licensor. Some of the things she thinks that the constituent believes that a fix-it ticket on site probably would have addressed the concerns, right? So this individual, her business is in the basement, not in the main parts of the home, okay? So the licensor claims that the toilets were clean, but in our area we have hard water, so right? So unless you want to use some real toxic chemicals that may harm the aquifers, sometimes it's just best just to let nature, you know, and maybe she's an environmentalist that way. So anyway, so hard water stains in the toilets. There's some wiring to the sump pump that's been, that was a question, and that wiring has been there for 16 years, the entire time she's been a provider. She went through the bathroom closet upstairs that's not used by anybody but her family to find nail polish remover, and that was added to the list of hazardous materials. And so she says, I mean, we have to live in our daycare. Also, what as providers do we need to do to put all that stuff under lock and key? And my constituent says, she makes me want to just quit. No wonder why there is a shortage in Minnesota. These licensors are pushing the good ones out. So then yesterday, I'm like, I didn't hear anything from licensor. So I'm like, well, I'm going to escalate it now up to Regina Wagner. Okay, still nothing. Not even an acknowledgement of we are looking into this, nothing. So it's not the money. You can throw all the money. You can offer all the money you want in these bills and say, you know what, we just added another $3 million to the initiatives and pat yourself on the back. But if you don't get to the heart and to the root of the problem, this doesn't do anything. It just makes you feel good and you can say, look at what I've done. Meanwhile, this is going on. These stories like this, that's the problem, Mr. Chair. That's the problem. It's not this.
Representative Brand, since it's your bill before us at this point, anything that you want to say in response to that?
I don't have a response to that. I don't represent DHS in any way. I've had very little contact with them. I've heard plenty of stories from folks, you know, over the years that have had issues and so on. You know, I think that that's something that our body needs to address. You know, and I think we will. I feel confident in that way, but that's not what my bill is about. You know, as a former city council member in St. Peter, we belong to the coalition of Minnesota cities, and so I represented St. Peter with 92 other cities in Minnesota. And all 93 communities were in St. Peter this last summer for their summer conference. It was MAKO St. Peter. And they toured our community center, and they talked with our city administrator and asked, you know, we have kind of polled the audience. How many people have a child care issue in their community? And everybody raised their hand. And they said, well, you know, if we could do what St. Peter did, we would be able to do that. But we don't have access to that kind of money. And not a lot of communities across our state have the advantages of some of the other communities like St. Peter. And so access to capital is really important in some of these. So I would respond by saying, it worked in St. Peter. And, you know, you look at this document. Every one of us received, I hope. I mean, I don't think I'm the only one that received this, because it's not really addressed to me, but the letters to the new governor produced by the Center for Rural Policy and Development, maybe I got an advanced copy, but in here on page 97, it states a couple of things that I think are, you know, worth sharing. It says, looking at the data from the last 12 years or so, it's apparent fairly quickly that the family child care providers are the ones leaving the business. In both Greater Minnesota and the Twin Cities area, both the number of providers and capacity dropped more than 25% since 2006. So the problem happened starting in 2006, according to their study. The number of centers and the number of spaces for children in those centers offered have been increasing over the same time period, but here the similarity between Greater Minnesota and the Twin Cities ends. Between 2006 and 2017, spaces at centers in the seven-county metro area increased by 24,000. More than making up for the loss in the 18,000 family care center spaces. In Greater Minnesota, however, loss of more than 22,000 family care spaces during those years was offset by an increase of only 7,000 spaces by new centers. In other words, while Twin Cities gained 6,000 child care spaces in the time period, Greater Minnesota lost more than 15,000. And again, they're pointing to 2006. That's before a lot of stuff was done in the legislature in terms of changing regulations and the parent aware wasn't even in existence at that time. And so I just don't see this as, and this isn't just germane to Minnesota. We look at our neighbors across the border in Wisconsin. They're also in a crisis. And I can guarantee right now the political makeup of that state's been a lot different for a lot longer. And they don't have the same regulations, and they don't have the same parent-aware program that we do in Minnesota, I don't think. Maybe I'm wrong, but I think it boils down to three things. This is kind of, I think, germane to where I'm trying to address some of this, or at least a portion of that. In greater Minnesota, there's a challenge with the economy of scale. There's greater overhead and startup costs are barrier. That's what 422 addresses. We have suppressed rates. You know, with dense populations, if somebody leaves, it's pretty easy to fill that spot. But if you're out in Nicollet, you're out in Lafayette, if you're out in some of the smaller communities where I represent, it's a lot more difficult to find somebody to be able to fill that spot. And so that cushion isn't there. And, you know, also Mankato, you know, more dense population, we've got, which I think are unhealthy conversations that are happening with child care providers about when they can start having their family, you know, grow. And the last thing is the pay is low for providers. And, you know, on page 97 of this, there's a chart that kind of shows what goes from, you know, I mean, daycare providers, sure, maybe you're paying $400 or $500 per month, or per week, rather, for your child for daycare up here. Now, where I live, it's probably a little bit lower. But on page 97 of this document, it shows what they spend their money on. And so there are a great deal of financial barriers to being a child care provider. I mean, frankly, it's highly regulated, and I think in a lot of ways it should be so. And I think it's a low income margin because they have to pay their staff, they have property tax, they have to pay for the food. There's a lot of things they have to pay for. There's not a lot of profit left over from those providers. But we still need them. We still need them in greater Minnesota. We still need them in Twin Cities. We need them everywhere. And so we need to address this issue. I'm talking to folks at Region 9. I'm talking to folks across the state of Minnesota. And they're saying it's a capital issue. There's barriers to entry. So that's what these two bills address.
Thank you, Representative Brand. And I think, and I may note, and Representative Franzen, I think this is going to be an ongoing discussion debate probably in the next 2 weeks as we're finalizing your vision reports, and I suspect the rest of the session. And so this will be an ongoing conversation that we'll be having, I'm sure. I guess I'll just say now that it seems to many of us, I think, that it's probably a both and, where clearly there's great improvement to be made in the regulatory system. And I guess just focus on this bill or these two bills. It does seem like when you've got the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities and the Greater Minnesota Partnership and the Chamber of Commerce and all these different groups coming together saying that this is needed, that's not at all to take away from the need for regulatory improvement, and also for many of us anyway, thinking that this is necessary as well. But it's an ongoing conversation and debate clearly we're going to be having. So Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah. Just real quickly, I appreciate that you mentioned you recognize that this isn't just a matter of dollars and cents. This is also a matter of the regulatory climate that I'm hearing many of the same stories that Representative Franz is hearing. I'm sure you are too, and I'm hoping that we're going to hear some bills relative to the regulatory problem as well.
And thank you, Representative Heintzman. So we heard a few maybe a week and a half ago. We're going to be hearing a bunch more on Monday. But certainly need to continue having that. And it seems to me that even when you have the one experience described by Representative Franzen, we want to make sure that you've got a system set up that's working, that's supporting the people who are doing such critical work. Because you described a small profit margin, and that assumes there is a profit margin. We want to be providing support. So thank you, Representative Heintzman. I think that may be it in terms of questions on this bill. Representative Brand, we'll give you the final word before moving on.
I just urge your support for 422.
Okay, thank you. And with that, Representative Katiza Watun, I think, was it your motion? I'm trying to guess. Yes, it was. Thank you. Renews her motion that House File 422 be passed on to Health and Human Services Finance. So it'll go from there. Mm-hmm. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. So House File 422 takes the next step in the process then. Mm-hmm. And then House File 423, mm-hmm. and maybe Representative Katiza Watun, you'd be willing to move this bill as well, and again with the same path to Health and Human Services Finance.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we'll get to that, yeah. Mm-hmm. You want to make that motion, Representative Katiza Watun? Thank you. And then we have an author's amendment. Coded A2, Representative Brand, you do want to have that offered, is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, and so we'll have Representative Katiza Watun offers the A2 amendment, author's amendment. Any discussion to that? And hearing none, all in favor of adoption of the author's amendment of the A2, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. House File 423 is in the form that you wish, and so Representative Brand, please describe your bill.
Okay. Just to address the amendment real quick.
Oh.
Just the language cleanup in haste to draft these bills, unfortunately. So the language didn't really fit to where we wanted it to be, so now it is. And so thank you for allowing me to amend that bill.
Yep.
So this is for the purpose of allowing new construction for new facilities in Minnesota. So we're asking for $10 million for this, for fiscal 2020, to be administered through the Commissioner of Human Services, I believe. Oh, I'm sorry, Deed. Yes, this is another bill. So this will be administered to the Department of Economic Development. Again, addressing this as an economic development issue. I know that these bills today for us are not silver bullet for Chandler Care, but I hope that's one of the four or five parts of that stool that we can address to make child care better for here in Minnesota. So with that, I would like to turn it over to Scott McMahon from Coalition.
Thank you, Representative Brand. And either you or maybe Mr. McMahon can do this, but if you can just give us a quick sense of the difference between these two bills, kind of what 423 is doing and the 422 wasn't, et cetera.
Yeah, for 422, that was for training. That was for the barriers to entry. 423 is actually barriers to capital investment, so building structures, stick and brick mortar buildings to provide new slot opportunities in Greater Minnesota.
Thank you. And then, Mr. Mann, please, identify yourself again, and then for the record, and then please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you again for the opportunity to testify on behalf of House File 423. Once again, I'm here on behalf of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities and the Greater Minnesota Partnership.
And you are Scott McMahon.
I am still Scott McMahon.
Thank you. We have just audio, so we want to make sure we get everybody. Thank you, sir.
House File 423 is the second part of our effort to stabilize and grow the child care industry in Greater Minnesota. This bill focuses exclusively on helping new providers enter and existing providers grow to address the 35,000 child care slot deficit in our communities. We know one of the biggest barriers to starting a new child care business in Greater Minnesota is accessing the capital necessary to do so. We have countless stories from providers in our communities who are looking at building a new care facility but can't develop a business model that supports operating the business and servicing the debt. We have stories of cities that are forced to step up and build child care facilities with resources they don't have because nobody else can, and the communities need them. We have stores and manufacturers and other businesses who are putting child care centers in their facilities because they need it in order to retain their workers. House File 423 will provide $20 million in accessible capital, $10 million in the state, and at least $10 million in matching funds from the private sector to address the infrastructure needed to grow 35,000 child care slots in Greater Minnesota. Thanks to the great work done by the Northland and Blandon Foundations, the IRRB, the Center for Rural Policy and Development, and the Wilder Research, we know that in the Northeast Region study, the average cost per slot in a new family care setting is $400 to $850 per slot, and for a new child care center slot is $2,000 to $5,000. Taking those numbers across all of Greater Minnesota, and assuming we grow child care slots under our existing ratio, two-thirds family care, one-third center care, we need between $35 million and $80 million in capital to fully build out our child care shortage in Greater Minnesota. The $20 million in capital funds provided in House File 423, again, $10 million in state funding, levers against at least $10 million in private funding, will fund 25% to 50% of the capital needs we have in Greater Minnesota. We know these efforts work. In recent years, the Initiative Foundations, Deed, First Children's Finance, and others have provided capital funds for child care expansion in our communities, and we have gotten new, stable, and successful businesses developed as a result. This is a proven effort. It is simply time to bring these efforts to scale. House File 422 focused on standing up our existing provider base and supporting new growth. Coupled with 423 is the fuel we need to drive beyond the child care crisis in Greater Minnesota, which will allow our local economies to grow, our communities to prosper, and our families access to the child care they need to thrive. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And your next testifier, Representative Brand, if you have another one.
Scott Marquardt.
Okay, please come up. Mark Wood, and identify yourself for the record, and then please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Scott Marquardt. I'm Vice President of Southwest Initiative Foundation, our economic development programs. We serve 18 counties and two Native nations, southwest corner of Minnesota, basically bordered by Ortonville, Laverne, Jackson, and Litchfield. I myself am a Montevideo resident, so I'm bringing a very rural, regional perspective to the conversation. I'm grateful for the chance to come and talk with you today about the fastest growing economic development issue facing our region by far. impacting job creation and retention, entrepreneurship, and business growth, not only in our region, but we know statewide also. This is a critical issue facing our region's employers as they work extremely hard to recruit and retain talent that they need to compete in the global marketplace. As I said, I'm grateful that this issue is receiving the attention that it is in this legislative session. It's impacting all sectors in our region. Who's called me in the last month? Law office, manufacturing plant, bank, Main Street stores, and everything in between. It doesn't matter. It's not high-paying jobs, medium-paid jobs, et cetera, fill in the blank. It's all throughout our communities. I won't take time. I know the hour's getting late to talk about stats. We know you've heard it multiple times. In our region alone, we have a shortfall of at least 3,100 child care slots. As Mr. McMahon said, this is having a significant impact on our company's decision-making on where they want to invest or expand in our areas. We're home to a thriving ag biotech sector and a number of other sectors really leveraging rural. And we know in those boardrooms and in those decisions and at those dinner tables and all the family businesses that we have, this is a major, major issue. A day does not go by where this doesn't hit my radar. It's probably the number one reason communities are calling in panic mode about the future of their communities in their region. And we're grateful for the chance to come and talk with you about a chance to get some help for it. We see a ton of business plans and pro formas coming through our office for startups, for child care enterprises, either under a center license or under a family license. These are visionary entrepreneurs. They're wonderful people, but they face many financial obstacles in their plans. And we feel that this bill will help provide the critical funding to help lessen the barriers related to planning and design, land acquisition, renovations, constructions, and equipment. Not having to debt service these expenses will be a critical part of sustainability and financial performance of child care enterprises. In many cases, the debt service and the upfront capital costs will stop a child care project dead in its tracks. We've seen it happen. It happens way too often. When we see a project pro forma, there's often a lot of red ink in the very first drafts, and those barriers require external investment and partnership so that these operations are sustainable, so that quality is not compromised, and so it's affordable for all families, regardless of their income and asset and balance sheet. I think what's huge about this bill to us from our perspective as a regional organization working at the community level is it covers both family child care and center-based care, and it covers both startups and expansion projects. As an economic development nerd, having the whole continuum of business projects is very important, especially as we think about ownership succession and our providers that want to retire. So hitting all sectors and all phases of the business cycle is huge for us. A one-size-fits-all approach does not work, absolutely will not work in greater Minnesota. We need to retain, we need to expand, and we need to develop new enterprises with a variety of organizational structures. What's really important about this bill is also how it's structured with organizational structure and how that will foster and catalyze innovative models that are proving to be transformational. In our region, we're seeing very cool collaborations between schools and hospitals, employer-driven innovative models, great engagement in the faith community, development of unique child care facilities under the family license in a non-residential setting, and new collaborations we haven't even dreamed of. Just as we're here today to discuss how the child care crisis is a business retention, expansion, and entrepreneurship issue, this bill also addresses the retention, expansion, and startup opportunities for child care. Regardless of what organizational structure a provider uses, child care is a business, it is an enterprise, so the intent of this bill aligns perfectly with the state's broader goals of creating, retaining, and expanding companies. I also want to emphasize the importance of how this bill is worded to cover expenses. Not only does it help tackle the high cost of facilities and construction, it also covers equipment and furnishings. When you get down to the granular level of a pro forma, equipment and furnishings is a big deal. This is huge, and it can be a large component of the startup business plans and the budgets that we see. We're grateful that equipment is part of this bill. I'm going to tell a quick story about Madison, Minnesota, the self-proclaimed Lutefisk capital of Minnesota. Population 1,400 in Lacapaw County near the South Dakota border. About 2 years ago on a cold January night, I had the privilege of facilitating a community planning session. Over 100 people showed up at the Legion in the town of 1,400. It's a pretty good deal. Senior citizens, kids, every age and walk of life in between. What did they say at the end of 2.5 hours that was most important to them? Child care and the future of their elementary school building. What's going to happen to that, and how do we deal with child care? Fast forward 2 years to about a couple of weeks ago, I had the privilege of attending the open house for Little Eagles Daycare, a new facility in Lacapaw Valley Elementary School in Madison. What's cool about that story, but more than it being community driven, was they had a banner on the wall of all the businesses and families and households that were involved. I think I counted 51 entries of either households, retired couples, business people, the electrician, the John Deere dealership, the bakery, everything in between came to the table to say, this is a big deal for our community. My point to that Madison story is I think that represents the innovation and the community drive that's happening right now. This bill will help more Madisons and more Little Eagles get cranking. It doesn't. Yes, these are very expensive ventures to start, but in greater Minnesota, the sweat equity, I know it's a buzzword, but the sweat equity, the leverage, the donations from John Deere dealership, the donations from the bakery, you know, 100 here, 1,000 there, it adds up, and we can together get over those barriers. I'll also tell a story, very quick one, on Worthington. We're home to, according to ACS data, the most diverse city in Minnesota, 34 languages in a town of, in the school district in a town of 13,000. What this bill can help do is foster innovative community solutions for culturally respectful and culturally appropriate child care so that our new families that are reversing the decline in population in greater Minnesota can thrive and those kids can have a safe place to be. So thank you again for the chance to come here today, and we sure hope this passes.
Thank you so much for your testimony and for your work. And to sitting to your left, and please make sure you speak right in the microphone. You can and please identify yourself and please begin.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman and committee. Thank you for allowing me to be here to speak this evening. My name is Jennifer Boland. I'm the city manager of the city of Eagle Lake, and I'm here to speak to you in support of House File Number 423. As a city manager of the city of Eagle Lake, this issue is very important to us. We want to see our community grow, and the child care shortage is currently an economic development issue in our community. The City of Eagle Lake supports legislation that provides grants to child care providers, local governments, and regional economic development organizations in greater Minnesota to build, upgrade, or expand child care facilities to increase capacity and meet state requirements. Access to capital is undoubtedly a barrier to developing new child care slots in our community and is an economic development issue. Our population has grown in recent years, and our resident births are increasing, which is resulting in higher demand for additional affordable and quality child care slots in our community. We recently were selected by Southern Minnesota Initiative Foundation to participate in a new program called Communities Addressing the Child Care Shortage for the purpose of developing an individualized action plan to help address our local child care needs. And according to the First Children's Finance partner of Smith, they've identified 107 slots as what we're short for daycare in Eagle Lake. We've employed local efforts to try to address this issue. We partnered with Blue Earth County, that's the county that Eagle Lake is located in, and they've allocated $35,000 in 2018 for the communities located in Blue Earth County, below $5,000 in population. That just scratched the surface. Through that process, we learned that there's a lot of providers out there that are really struggling. A lot of the issues you've already heard tonight, those are the same things we hear at the local level. But the barrier to capital, that is an issue that we hear time and time again, that we have providers that are in their homes, they would love to expand to a center-based facility, but they just don't have the financial resources to be able to do that. And we also have a center that is thriving in our community that would like to expand, but again, has barriers to accessing capital. So I wanted to leave with you a handout that I put together. I included a couple photos of my children. I previously, before working in Eagle Lake, I worked in Jackson, Minnesota, and the child care shortage was a huge issue in that community as well. Instead of being excited when I was pregnant with my first child, I was stressing every day calling our child care center director begging for a spot because it was so difficult to get in there. So there's lots of issues, and I know you're aware of them, but I just wanted to share with you my personal story. Also, Eagle Lake being close to Mankato, and moving to Eagle Lake and not being able to find child care in our community, in the community that I live and work, and I have to drive to a nearby community to take my kids to daycare and then come back to work. So thank you again for your time, and I just, on behalf of the city of Eagle Lake, would like to urge your support of House File Number 423.
Thank you very much. Thanks for sharing your testimony. Anyone else who wishes to testify on the bill, we'll have Ms. Cunningham come up. And so please identify yourself for the record. You speak right in the microphone, and then please proceed.
I'm Cindy Cunningham. I'm the Public Policy Chair for my friends, the Association. I've been studying this bill for a while. I haven't been able to testify in any other way. But a couple comments in general. Every time I hear pay is low, costs are high, please remember this is on centers. All I keep hearing tonight on this bill is centers. You are not. I would like to talk to whoever said that the goal was two-thirds family, one-third center. This bill won't do that. Okay.
I didn't have to pay my taxes. I made plenty of money this last year. As a family child care provider, my overhead, because it's in my home, because of the tax deductions that I am afforded, because of how I'm able to run my business, I do live here in St. Paul, but trust me, I get plenty. Probably took 5 calls already this week, people looking for infants. You know, it's real everywhere. But I have a really good business. The centers, in particular, the chain centers, have great office buildings, have great administration, pay their upper management quite well. It is their employees they are choosing to not pay. And I'm going to use the word choosing not to pay. Small centers of single owners, of many I come to know, don't do that. They are paying their employees, they're working with those systems because they don't have this large chain overhead that's happening, that's expanding, that's being promoted. Because this includes Parent Aware, I'll make a couple of comments based on other things that were said. I'm not anti-Parent Aware. I'm just like, can we fix it and make it so that the culture and the process is reasonable, is equitable, is accountable? And the statistics about family child care participating is, I would say, a little slanted. Really look at the chart. If you look at the numbers, it's centers, it's not people in the centers. It's the number of centers compared to family child care and the number of family child care that are participating at the 3- and 4-star or significantly less starting 2020 next year. Early learner scholarships can only be spent at 3- and 4-star rated programs. So we are going to have just another crisis next year. I've worked on introducing a bill in the Senate to have that brought back. And it's a struggle because everybody's starting to talk about higher quality. Quality is not okay. Parent Aware rating system's not okay. We have to have a 3-4-star. Then your quality. Then you're presenting and preparing children for kindergarten. I just had the conversation with the senator in the hallway right before I came over here. We've got to get to the point to say that continuity of care, the University of Minnesota says, continuity of care, parents' involvement in child care, parents' involvement in the child's education, the parents' socioeconomic status, the parents' education. That's what makes the difference in a person's and a child's educational success. That study's been out since 89. There was another one somewhere after that. We need to really look at what presents quality. You can go to the Search Institute and read what are the key qualities that kids, in retrospect, needed in their lives. It was not a child care that was quality rating. It was someone who loved and cared for them. It was someone who was connected to the families. It was someone who was with them. I have a child in my care right now who has been with me for 10 years. I have her 3 other siblings. My licensor, I was re-licensed this morning, we're doing just fine. But my licensor is like, I have siblings. I do. People bring me their kids. They bring me their siblings. Thankfully, they keep bringing me their siblings. So a couple things with all of this is there is no study that has said where the achievement gap children are coming from. Until that study gets done, we've got to quit pigeonholing saying, well, this is the answer. There's no study that says, where do the kids come from that are not in the achievement gap? Low income at risk. Here's what part of the problem is. People already are taking their children to illegally unlicensed care. There's no crackdown on illegally licensed care. I've been reporting one person for about 3 years. No one will shut this person down. And she has a billboard as if it's a center. No one will touch her in the county of Ramsey. Not a person, not licensing, not the county attorney, no one. And I know she's over capacity, and I know she's there. They've investigated her. No one will shut her down. Quality, 3-4-star, sounds nice. When are we going to start looking at the people who are legally? And if you're going to force and put money in that it only can be Parent Aware, you're really not addressing the problem slots. Because you're asking for multiple hoops, you're asking for multiple directions. If we can get people licensed, as much as I have testified many times about DHS, I'm not going to do that here. But at least we should be able to get people in the system so that there's a process, there's oversight. Then you all can fix the system, please. So those are some of the pieces on that. One of my biggest concerns about this, though, is from a dollar sense, this is centers. This is not for family child care. When I opened my home, we drive 2 miles up the road for it, there were things I needed to do. There was things that, yes, would have helped me do that. Yes, I did increase my capacity. But when you tie this amount of money to structure, all the testifiers, it's center. It's not family child care. The affordable affordable child care is family. So when we talked about improvement, DEED programs
typically, I've never known, and I've done some checking, will not loan to family child care providers because guess what? You're going to improve my home. You're not improving a building. So our qualifiers and our ability to get these loans, to get these grants, historically has been a barrier. We can't get them unless they're run through other system. I actually was here first to testify, retained. Thank you. I really want that one too. But unless this is written in a way that takes out those barriers for family child care, just understanding what you're going to be getting in your communities are centers. You're going to get chain centers. Mm-hmm. They're going to take the process. You are actually going to lose. You take Worthington, you take wherever.
I'm going to ask you to wrap up if you can, please. I'm sorry.
If you take the populations of these communities and you say those are slots, if you can make many of those people employable by running their own businesses in their homes, you would be creating more slots. You would be putting people to work in their own businesses. But this has to be changed so that it actually can be feasible for family child care, or it's not a good thing.
Thank you so much. Thanks for your testimony. Anyone else who wishes to testify, please. Yeah. And please identify yourself again for the record, and then please proceed with your testimony.
Here on behalf of myself, I am Jagger. I'm winging this one, so bear with me.
Okay.
I'll tell this little story because obviously I'm home to care, and I do have concerns about the home portion of this being as tied to Care and Aware. Not that I'm a territory or hate train, but I guess I am tonight. But anyway, if anyone has had a negative action, I've been licensed 20 years and completely compliant, it's not anything. I do CPR. I'm not Care and Aware qualified anymore. What that does, when you guys give money to Care and Aware programs and initiatives like this, it undercuts my pricing. Because what happens is those scholarships allow parents to pay less for their child care at those locations, undercutting what I can charge, and it takes the available pool of clients for me. And I may have 12 slots, but if someone can get it for free, four blocks down, that's where they go. And eventually, it squeezes me to a point I have to close. So I know someone testified back here previously about we don't know exactly why they're closing. That's why. There's a portion of us in a pool that have been licensed for a duration of time. If we've had a negative action or a corrective action in that way, we can't qualify for Care and Aware, and we are not allowed in those programs. So there's a whole pool of us that are disallowed from participation. That also happens when you guys give money to increasing school programs. I sat on school board for 8 years, so I got to be part of that fund. But we rolled out an early learning program, as that was the way we were going, and it closed all of the home providers in one of our small parent communities within a year. These programs hurt home care. They decrease spots, and overall, the city Cunningham's right when it's, if you can increase your family child care, you will increase your slots overall, and you increase the health of your community, because these are small communities. I live in a town of about 1,500 outside of Rochester, which is now over 100,000. We're a bedroom community. People drive in Roch. But when they put in big centers, which they just put one in with EDA dollars and all these great things that have really pretty names, they hurt us small providers because they take our tax dollars and they put a big building that can undercut our rates blocks from our house. And it just does not help us, and it hinders the entire process. What can we do to support family providers? Yes, we need to ease regulations without deterring health and safety. Nobody wants health and safety to be on the line. We all want our kids safe. But we need to ensure that along those lines, we give the appropriate steps to allow us to have the substitutes and the capacities that allow us the expansion within our square footage to ease those tensions. And there's enough people that want to stay home with their children. We need to ease that burden of trying to be licensed. And we also need to not tie programs like CCAP and Parent Aware to funding that disable our ability to operate as a small business at a competitive level. Because if you have one car dealership offering, you know, free rebates for a free car, and the same car another dealership has to sell at full price, which dealership's going out of business? I mean, it's just simple math and small business. So that's what happens when we do those things. So
I'm really sorry for being on the Patriot
fan, but yeah, not with you. So thank you.
Thank you for sharing your testimony. Thank you. Anyone else who wishes to speak? Please, yeah. So again, identify yourself for the record, please, again.
Yes, my name is Brittany Brennan, former child care center director of Mankato, and lead pre-K teacher. So I just kind of want to put my two cents in a little bit here, because I'm literally in the process right now of trying to open my own. I have three banks that are ready to go. I have construction workers that are ready to go. Everything's ready. I've got 50 families. I've got all the staff. What's the one thing that's stopping me? DHS. How can I open up a center when I have to literally think about, will they even license me? Again, this is going to sound like a broken record, but throw all the money, have all these great ideas, but until you fix DHS, it's really not going to help anything. That's the one thing that's literally stopping you. I can get the banks on the board right now. I can sign on the dotted line. I have a property. I have 3 properties that I could go on, ready to open. But it would be them coming in, realizing who I am, and saying, we remember you. No. I did Parent Aware. In fact, I did the pilot program in 2010. I got a 3-star then. I did the Parent Aware pilot program for 3 years, 2013. I signed up to do it. I got slammed with 25 citations. Parent Aware said, now you don't qualify because you got negative actions. I was done from then on. DHS is the problem. I love all these ideas. They're really great. But you're not going to get anywhere until you fix DHS, until you get those licensors, until you get Reggie, the whole shebang of them. Please. I'm ready. I'm qualified. I have a list of people that would tell you that. I have the passion. I have the background. I'm ready to open tomorrow if I could. But my husband and I are definitely on the fence because who's going to protect me? Who's going to be standing there when I hand in that paper? Is it going to be you? Will one of you come with me to help defend me? And say, look at all this great stuff. I'm wanting to do it, you guys. I really do. I have the support. I have everything in mind. I just can't because of DHS. And they're targeting me. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Anyone else who wishes to testify? Ms. Benninger.
Yeah,
come on up. And so you want to identify yourself just so we get it on the record, and then please proceed.
My name is Elizabeth Fingers.
Okay.
Mine's a little practical question about this bill. What's to stop someone from taking $500,000, putting it into a building, and then selling it? What happens to all that? Because there's literally no curbs on these 3 pages. And then, why are we allowing grants on line 3.6 to 3.8? Grants must not be awarded for more than $500,000 per project or more than $2 million in 2 years to an applicant for 1 or more projects in the same city or county. So is that a shame? I'm feeling like that's a shame. And as I know, as I've said, and as the 3,000 pages of data will tell you, we have a little bit of a problem with chains in this state. So there's no curbing that says someone can't turn this into another fraudulent program of flipping buildings on my tax dollar. And again, in 2 years. So if we're creating a fund, which we're doing, once we create an account, we all know where that goes in Minnesota. It's a permanent taxpayer money tree. In 1.8 through 1.11, we're creating a whole facility capital grant account. Been down that road before with my tax dollars pass on that. Because all you're going to do is dump money into it year after year. So theoretically, a person could open 4 centers every 2 years to the tune of $500,000 over and over and over again. Which in my county probably wouldn't work because I'm in Nicollet County. Mr. Brennan's my representative, sorry. but if you're in Hennepin County or somewhere, it's like nonstop chain the palooza. I mean, no offense, don't do that. This is ridiculous. Please put some curbs in here. I mean, you're probably going to take my tax dollars anyway, but just put some curbs in. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Thanks for your testimony. Anyone else wish to testify for or against the bill? I'm not seeing anyone. We've got a question from Representative Cortese-Vitoon.
Oh, passing? Okay.
So then any other questions from members at all at this point? Not seeing any. Thank you for the reminder. I was forgetting earlier today. Representative Brandt, I should do you the courtesy of allowing you to provide final thoughts on your bill.
Yeah, absolutely. So the first bill was addressing, I guess, just to clarify, so everybody is aware that making decisions.
Could you put the mic in front of you? I want to make sure you actually record it. Thank you.
I feel like I'm the radio.
Yep. So right into the mic.
So House File 422, just to be clear, that was for in-home providers. 423 is specifically for centers. And so I just want to make that distinction. That's the way that these bills work together.
Can I just ask a question on that? So 422 is specifically for family child care and not for centers. Looks like you may be getting a clarification there. I just want to make sure we're...
Well,
for both, I guess.
23 can be for both, but primarily, you know what I mean. $500,000. And most of the family providers are in-home providers, and so we're not advocating, obviously, that they build a new home, but maybe an addition or something like that, or a renovation, that sort of thing. Maybe the basement needs some help, that sort of thing as well. But primarily, that's what this will tackle. I mean, the bottom line is we need both. We need both in Minnesota. We live in a capitalistic world. It is necessary not to have monopolies. It is necessary to have choice for parents. And so I support both. In Nicollet County, where I represent, I've got 16 providers that are centers, and we've got 45 providers who are in-home daycares. And so it's nice to have a mix of both. It's nice to have parents have an option for both. And so we're still down slots. We're still down thousands of slots across the state of Minnesota. And so what I would recommend tonight is that we pass 423. And you know, if you have any questions about the bill, I'm more than willing to work on you to work with you and make the bill better. But I think it's a good bill. I really do. And I think that this would address some of the issues. Again, I don't propose this as a silver bullet. I'm not advertising this as the silver bullet for child care. And I think we need to work together across the aisles to make it a better occupation. I'm the vice chair of the Ag Committee, and I work across the chair, work across the aisle with Republicans all the time to try to make farming better. And I see these as not dissimilar in function. It's a low profit, highly regulated industry. And so we're working on ways together to make it better. Of course, you know, with agriculture, you've got weather and other concerns. But here in Minnesota, we've got a situation where we have opportunity to provide new folks in communities with new options. So that's what I'm here to do today.
Thank you. Thank you for bringing it forward. And to confirm, with both these bills, they'll be under consideration, I think, eventually for Jobs and Economic Development.
Yes.
Committee and consideration as to how they'll fit in the budgets of that, the budget overseen by that committee.
Right.
So with that, then, Representative Cortizo Witun renews her motion, House File 423, be referred to the Committee on Health and Services Finance, as amended. Thank you. That House File 423 as amended. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. Congratulations. Both those bills move. With that, members, Representative Franson, please. Yeah.
Hi.
Hello.
Okay, so Mr. Chair,
yes.
These are a few of the facts that we know from the OLA report, that the fraud is real, it's more pervasive than the agency will admit, and not limited to just the fraudulent billing or employment scams, but includes failure to provide the services required. The table was set for fraud in none of the proposals. We have heard here in the Early Childhood Division thus far have done anything to reset that table. In fact, as we saw last week, Mr. Chair and members, House File 1, as amended, thank you, Representative Heinzman, for bringing those concerns forward to the committee, would make it worse in giving added legal protections to those admitting to fraud and enormous discretion to the commissioner to put the best interests of the program ahead of the taxpayers. That's concerning. Mr. Chair, while this division has not yet seriously dug into the issues of child care fraud, I do recognize and appreciate that you have expressed and share a genuine interest to find the truth and do what is best for the parents and children relying on these programs, as well as the honest, law-abiding providers whose reputations are jeopardized when the integrity of the entire program is in question. Therefore, Mr. Chair, I will request that you summon Ms. Carolyn Hamm to appear before this division in the near future to address her flagrant dereliction of duty. And Mr. Chair, I move that this division request of the Chair of the Committee on Ways and Means that Carolyn Hamm, DHS Inspector General, be issued a subpoena by the Committee on Ways and Means to appear before the Early Childhood Finance and Policy Division on March 21st, 2019 to answer questions regarding the Child Care Assistance Program fraud and management of the Child Care Investigations Unit.
So, Representative Francis, I heard a request, but then I heard you say a motion. So is it, you started as a motion.
Yes, I made a motion to have... Do you want me to repeat it?
No, that's fine. Well, let's first just, I don't know if anybody in House Research has any idea as to whether such a motion can even be made. Anybody have any idea? It seems I've never heard of such a thing.
I have the wording from House Research.
The wording for the motion?
Yeah.
Okay.
Only Ways and Means can issue the subpoena.
So it's even so much. Hold on a second. So, I don't know if you're Hermie, you're filling in for Mr. Burris. But any, has our House got any...
I can hand you the motion.
No, please do, yeah.
Mr. Chair and members, I don't have the statute book in front of me about legislative subpoenas, but my understanding is that a standing committee of the House could, two-thirds of the members could vote to subpoena someone to appear before that committee. But as Senator Franzen mentioned, that applies to a standing committee, which I think that's what she means by ways and means. Ways and means would have to do it. So I don't know, I don't have personal experience in legislative subpoenas in my role. I don't know if there's precedent for a division of a full standing committee to make a motion to request that full committee to take a vote to subpoena someone, but I think that's the motion that Representative Franzen
is. I guess I'm just wondering... So can a motion, and I'm wondering less about the subpoena part, because yeah, it seems like we can't issue that, and it seems like the motion, the language recognizes that, but I'm just even confused about whether or not the motion itself is in order, whether you can make such a motion.
Well, we got the information, Mr. Chair, from House Research.
Okay, the information, I guess when you say the information,
yeah,
what do you mean by
exactly what's
that?
In front of you right there, on what the proper motion would be.
To move, so then, so can a motion be made to request that we do... That seems very strange. And so I gather, but you all don't have any, our House Research team is not aware of any of this in advance of this, okay?
No. Mr. Chair, no, but I believe that President Johnson did talk to someone else in my office, and
okay.
they must have recommended that this committee could entertain a motion.
So the committee, okay. Can you just provide advice? At that point, is the committee then required to vote on it, or something that I, as chair, can just sort of consider? I'm just trying to understand, Representative Francis. I was not aware of this before just now, so I'm just trying to...
I think we take a vote on the committee, whether or not you're going to entertain the motion.
So, I mean, basically, though, could you make a request that the committee do just about anything, and then we make a motion? I'm just trying to figure out what the boundaries are for a motion to request. I move the division do... I'm just trying to figure out what the boundaries are of that. Do folks understand what I'm asking? Well... Yeah, I'm just trying to understand.
Well, I can't speak to the boundaries, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
But this is a proper motion given to us by Health Research.
Well, I understand. Okay. Oh. Yeah, I guess I'm not so you all know that somebody was in House Research was spoken to. I just don't want to make sure that we're doing things properly. I tell you what, here's a question. So the committee will be meeting on Monday. I wonder if what we could do at that point, we can get this actually confirmed that such a motion is in fact in order. Because I'm trying to figure out, could you move that the division do? I'm trying to think of something that would come across as silly.
Pardon me? Serve pie.
Yes. I mean, I want to be careful, and I'm not all trying to make light of this. But I am trying to figure out, I've just never heard of such a motion.
Today is a new day.
Well, no, I guess it is. I'm hearing of it now, Representative Franzen, that's right. I would point out that I had not heard of it before, so I guess and it might have been good if we'd known about this at the beginning, even of this evening hearing, we possibly could have reached out to folks to get confirmation of that, because I'm just not sure that this is a proper motion. And I have some Representative Heinzman, you're going to add into this, please.
I am going to add to this.
Please, sir, yeah.
Request that our vote be a roll call vote.
Good, I was anticipating that, so at least we got that. So if it is, in fact, a proper motion, can have a vote, then it will be a roll call vote, Representative Heinzman. You got that. Representative Pryor, yeah, please.
Is it possible, then, to table the motion?
Is it possible to table the motion?
As you said, because we have Monday, we have plenty of meetings.
Well, that's kind of what I'm thinking, yeah. I think we just didn't realize on our team here that there was going to be parliamentary action. So it might have been good to...
I will, Mr. Chair, if I may, I will move to table this motion.
Okay.
And I'll see if that's in order.
Okay. And if we get advice, okay. Fair enough. And recognizing that we can have the time to take a look at it, we can have the vote on Monday. That should still leave time.
Or Monday, or whenever we're ready.
Whenever we're ready, yeah.
Monday is
a
busy day.
Oh, House Research.
Okay, House Research. Okay.
We can table it and act of higher precedent.
Take a look. Okay, hold on a second. And pardon me, audience, as we're sorting this through, I just had not heard of this before. So that's fine. I'll take a look at it. Yeah, thanks. Give me a second.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Heisman, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
To Representative Pryor's motion, I would also request a roll call.
Understood. Thank you, Representative Heisman. So there will be, if assuming that we do that, then there certainly will be a roll call. Well, I hate to do this. I hate to do this, but I'm afraid. I think what we're going to do is, everybody, I'm just thinking about this here. We'll tell you what. Why don't we take a several-minute recess? I want to be able to assess this. And let's plan to come back in about, let's take about 5 minutes, I think is all we're going to need. And then we'll come back. Okay? So I'm putting the committee in recess, and we'll come back in 5 minutes. Okay? Thank you. Okay, we are, I don't know if I have to do this, coming back out of recess, but what can I do? I get it. So we are back, I'm reconvening the committee, we've got folks around. Okay, so we have a motion, we had a motion by Representative Franson, a purported motion anyway, and then a motion by Representative Pryor. And I think, why don't I explain my thinking here? So I spoke with, is Mr. Burris is...
It's
on the hallway. Okay. So my understanding is that, and I want to make sure to leave, to have House Research be able to be and not be drawn into this too much. So my understanding is, while it's true, House Research did in fact put together this language in response to request, my understanding is that that is not necessarily a statement that the motion is either in order or out of order. We don't want to have pull House Research into that. So it's not a statement by House Research, certainly, that this is in order, or again, or out. It simply was, there was a request that the language be drafted, and I think assistance provided that there couldn't be a subpoena directly by this committee, but that does not affect that. And so, Representative Pryor, I'm going to ask you to withdraw your motion to lay on the table. Okay, and that's withdrawn. And then I am going to rule that this motion is, in fact, out of order. As I say, I don't understand what where this would even be drawn from to be able to do such a thing. And so I'm ruling that this motion is out of order. Thank you for that and for the concern expressed. Representative Heisman, yeah, please.
I would challenge the ruling of the chair. On appeal.
I'm not sure that you can do that in committee. Anybody have any idea? Have any parliamentary experts here? I kind of think that in committee that may be the end of it, but I'm not sure. Anybody have any sense?
Perhaps we should adjourn.
I think at this point, what we'll do is we'll keep the conversation going. Representative Heisman, if you can identify some pieces here, anybody else can. But in the meantime, what I'm inclined to do is to adjourn. But thank you, and let's keep this conversation going. And thank you so much, Representative Heisman. I'll let you. Yeah,
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair. So I think it's something conclusive to confirm that somehow I'm not allowed to appeal the ruling of the chair. If you made a ruling, I should be able to appeal it. That's my understanding. But there's got to be something conclusive in the rules, I would think, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I think I'm going to answer. I don't believe that you can, but I could well be wrong on that. But I don't believe that you can. And so, again, what I'm inclined to do is we're going to adjourn. We'll have continued conversation.
I think we're going to find that answer out real quick, right?
Okay.
So per Mason's,
yes,
that allows us to appeal the ruling of any chair.
And does anybody have Mason's with us? Looks like Mr. Withers may be pulling up. But I will point out that Mason's is not our highest authority. In fact, it's below by a couple notches. I know the custom usage, for example, takes precedence over Mason's. In my experience, rulings of chairs on such things are in fact final. That's not true in the chamber, but it is true in committees. And so I think the custom usage would say that in fact it cannot be appealed. So I am inclined to pull the plug. I want to be respectful of minority. I spend most of my time in the minority. I want to be respectful of it. I'm not whacking the gavel down here, but I really would like to represent Franson.
Oh, sure. Yeah. So Mason's 250 Part 2 says an appeal from a decision of the presiding officer must be made promptly if it is too late to appeal after debate or other business has intervened. When a committee has acted on a bill and that bill is reported to the floor, it is in order to object to a committee report, and any grounds or argument can be cited.
including poor behavior or actions by the committee or chair. That is not an appeal of the ruling. It is an argument of the committee report be rejected.
And Representative,
so the appeal was made promptly.
Right, Representative Franson, all that is referring to floor, to action on the floor, and not referring to action and perhaps on a bill as well, but not referring to action in committee. As I say, whatever Mason says, the thing is you've still got the issue of customer usage taking precedence over Masons, and as I say, I have never heard of or seen such a thing in my experience in committees. I don't know if folks can identify that, or again, we've got folks from research who may have that experience, but otherwise...
Well, we did get this information from House Research.
Well, you got the... and thank you, Representative Franson. You got the language from House Research, but again, we did get clarification that that was not a statement...
And the Masons section as well. And,
And so, Representative Franson. Yeah, we'll make sure we're going through the chair. Okay. Representative Franson. Yeah.
So, Mr. Chair, thank you. Sorry about that. No problem. So, we've done quite a bit of discussing of the topic of is this appropriate or is this not appropriate... can we subpoena, can we not subpoena? The issue is that we have a major problem. We're going to be gone for the weekend now. We're going to be going back to our districts, and our constituents are wondering, what are you guys doing? You've been in session for weeks now. Not one bill has been brought forward to start bringing some integrity into this public program. There's going to be another report that the OLA will be releasing on some of the other programs within DHS that I'm afraid are going to find some findings that aren't going to make the taxpayers very happy as well. And so, Mr. Chair, I just feel that we do need to get Carolyn Hamm in front of our committee, ask her these important questions, and find out exactly why there is such a rift in the department and why she would rather discredit her own employees rather than actually dig in to the fraud and say, listen, we have a problem. How can we work with one another to end the fraud instead of fingers pointing back and forth? And here we are today.
Thank you, Representative Franson. Thanks for that perspective. Thank you all, members. This has been a really good and enlightening day and an interesting discussion at the end of it. And at that point, Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you do choose to rule out of order today, we want it clear that your decision is not to let an appeal, that your decision to not let this be an appeal, that it's not a precedent, okay? We don't want to make this precedent.
I guess I'm not quite sure what that means exactly. And certainly, as you know, I like dialogue, and certainly if you identify some issues, things before, please bring up to me. So, yeah, so Representative Franson.
If, Mr. Chair, if we can just put the challenge in the minutes, that would be great.
Oh, thank you, Representative Franson. Absolutely. Yeah, we will note Representative Franson bringing that point up, certainly. Thank you, members and guests, for sticking with us. And we will be back on Monday at 9 a.m., I believe. I'm hearing actually a number of bills on regulation, so it should be good. With that, the meeting is adjourned.